Tonight on The Download, urban planner and historian Jonathan Rose, Chicago's youth poet laureate Iman Loren, and from the legendary comedy group The State, Kevin Allison. And now here's your host, a man who lives every day like it's game seven, Justin Kaufman.
Sort of. If jittery, walking around, dazed, not sure, just waiting till it's 7 o'clock, yeah, I always live like it's game seven. Welcome to 720 WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is a download with you till 11 o'clock tonight. I should say with you till this game is over. Post-game will start when the final pitch, the final out of the World Series. Game 7, the Cubs and Indians. Woo! Wow. What an emotional time in Chicago, huh? It really is to think about all that goes with this. You know, it's just a game. It's just baseball. But at the same time, it represents so much more. Family, generations. We talked about it last week, even Bob Newhart, who said the famous line from his stand-up routine, which is, you know, when life's going well, the Cubs are a lot like life. When it's going well, you know you're going to blow it. That could be changed tonight. And early on yesterday, I got to say, Pete, I really felt yesterday the hyperbole started early. Like right when it was 3-0, you started to see on Twitter, tomorrow game 7, the biggest game in the history of game. Essentially it, you know, like the horns were playing, you know, it was like ancient Greece and it was the first Olympics ever. That's where we were at. But I got to say, for Chicago, this may be the most historical game in sports history. You agree?
Next to the Stings championship, yes, in the early 80s.
Or just a blitz regular season game.
It's exciting.
A friend of mine texted me today and he said, you know, I haven't felt like this since game 7 of the Pacers-Bulls 96.
Oh, 90, yes.
98. If you remember that game 7 Eastern Conference final where the Bulls played the Pacers. And the Pacers, and we're going back and forth, remembered that the Pacers got up big in that game and it was Tony Kukoc. When Pippen and Jordan couldn't get it going, Kukoc led the second team, the bench mob, if you will, from that era, scored a ton of points and brought them back to win that game. So who's going to be tonight's Tony Kukoc? Might be the question. There's got to be a Kukoc. So far, it seems like it might be Dexter Fowler, free range. Amazing. The Chicago Cubs and the Cleveland Indians, game 7. We know tonight that it is a big night. I'm not going to sit here and act like we don't know that the game is on and that you're watching it. We understand it's a tough, it's a tough show to download. It's a tough show to program tonight. Do we sit here and get a bunch of people in and just talk about what we see on a screen or do generic sports? And we decided, Pete and I both decided that no, we were going to do a regular show tonight. Then around 9:30, 10 o'clock, start to turn our attention to baseball. Obviously, Andy Mazur, Adam Hogue will be in studio. Kevin Powell and Mark Carmen are both in Cleveland tonight. We've got Ryan Burrows and others that are going to be up in Wrigleyville. So we have a lot going on, and we're going to start that coverage probably around 10 o'clock tonight as the game starts to wrap up. If it wraps up before that, if this is one of those boom, boom, boom games, we'll be here for you with the True Blue Playoff Plus presented by Wintrust, home of Cubs checking. All right, so much more to do tonight. We got a lot to do. So tonight we decided we're going to talk we'll talk some urban planning. A tremendous book by urban planner and historian Jonathan Rose talks about the future of the American city. It's called The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life. It's a really, really interesting look about what we've done in the past as human beings and how it is going to be used to help us inform the future. You know, this isn't a great example is this is not our first rodeo when it comes to climate change. This planet and ancient civilizations has dealt with glaciers and so many other things that have gotten in the way of the urban experience. So we will talk with Jonathan Rose about what we should be doing right now to think about what life is going to be like in 50, 100, 200 years from now. Also, the Youth Poet Laureate of Chicago. What a great, unbelievable that the Youth Poet Laureate of Chicago, Iman Loren, is 20 years old, 19 years old? She is the Youth Poet Laureate. She's going to be in studio tonight. We'll talk to her about her career. She started with Louder Than a Bomb, which is a tremendous citywide poetry tournament, but we'll talk to her about that coming up. And also, Kevin Allison's going to be here to talk about coming to Chicago Podcast Festival. Kevin Allison does a tremendous podcast which is called Risk, True Tales Boldly Told. Kevin Allison will join us to talk about what he's bringing to the Chicago Podcast Festival and about his success since being in the legendary comedy group The State. So that's all coming up tonight. We got a great show, so why don't we get to it? News, weather, and traffic, and Cubs updates with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by the biggest Cub fans in the world, Pete Zimmerman. Are you feeling okay? Are you feeling good? How do you feel about being at work tonight?
I'm all right.
Do you feel like this is the kind of thing where this is just a job and you wish you'd call in sick like so many other Chicagoans did today? Do you want to call in sick? Would you rather be on your couch than be at WGN watching it and getting ready for postgame?
Yeah, probably in this instance, if it was like a regular, you know, the show must go on, Justin.
Right, right.
If it was a regular, you know, if I was an electrician,
right,
you know, I'd probably take the night off.
Someone's like, I got no power. Yeah, Cubs are game seven.
And tomorrow off, right, depending on what happens. And the parade off, depending on what happens.
And then the Cubs convention off. Then all of spring training. Pete Zimmerman, of course. I'm Justin Coffin. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, it's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin with you till 11 o'clock. We'll also have post-game when this game is over, Game 7 of the World Series. But right now, let's get to the carryout. Let's kick it off the way we kick it off every night. This is where I read the news, so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Well, it's time for the biggest game ever, and I'm not talking about Jackie Rogers' 100,000 jackpot wad. Nope, it's the World Series. It's underway, and the Cubs are playing for all the baseballs. What more can you say about it, really? The Cubs have given us all the feels all season long, and it's wildly appropriate that to break the curse, they got to break some hearts. Cleveland hearts, hopefully. Thousands of Cub fans have made the trek to Cleveland via planes, trains, and automobiles. Maybe even a Great Lake liner or two. Go old school, like Stowaway on a Petco barge. It'll take like 2.5 weeks. Maybe someone planned it out in advance. Whatever the outcome, it's November 2nd, and the boys in blue are still playing. Good luck. Godspeed. In other news tonight, if there is such a thing, the 2016 election may have taken a backseat in Illinois due to the World Series. But around the country, it's heating up. Network polls show the race tightening, although that's what a network poll is supposed to do. See ratings. The electoral map is tightening as well. Here's what I hope happens. Popular vote, tie. Electoral college, tie. Then it goes to the House of Representatives where Paul Ryan orchestrates a tie. Then how about the Supreme Court? Tie, right? 4-4. Then finally we decide on a double dare-like physical challenge where both candidates have to dive into a kiddie pool full of fudge. At least we think it's fudge. And then the grand finale is a lie detector test and both fail and we have to do another year of campaigning. I mean, really, it's the best case scenario. Locally, Rahm Emanuel says he's not giving back a Donald Trump donation to his mayoral campaign from back in 2011. Emanuel and city council are removing his honorary street sign, but Emanuel? No, he's going to teach him a lesson. He's not going to give back the money. Also begs the question, why was Donald Trump giving money to Rahm Emanuel in 2011? Something tells me the mayor and the alderman may not be telling the whole truth when they said, hey, you know what? Our hands are tied. He can put his name on the building. It's zoning. So again, why was Trump giving money to Emanuel for mayor? And why did former Alderman Bert Nateris tell DNA Info, hey, Trump was a different person when I met him at a party at Mar-a-Lago in Florida? Really? Really? Come on, you guys. That's ridiculous. Trump seems to give a lot of money to Chicago politicians before he badmouthed them on the campaign trail. But yeah, Trump's an outsider. Right. Come on. It's ridiculous, guys. Gannett Newspapers reportedly pulled their offer off the table to buy Tronc, formerly Tribune Publishing. Tronc is run by Michael Farrow, who showed very little interest in the sale and reportedly asked for way more than Gannett was willing to offer. So what does that mean? I don't know. Maybe a new slogan? Tronc, we ask for more. But we usually don't get it. The protests over a crude oil pipeline in North and South Dakota seems to be working as President Obama is asking the Army Corps of Engineers to look at a secondary plan to keep the pipeline away from the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe land, specifically a lake that's the main source of drinking water. So all that checking in you did this weekend on Facebook, hey, it worked. In other news, Facebook announced huge third quarter profits off of your protest check-ins. Hey, there's money to be made somewhere, everywhere. In weather, man, I'm going to hate it when summer ends. It's crazy. In sports, the Cubs are currently underway in Game 7 of the World Series. No big deal. Kyle Hendricks will start, but John Lester and John Lackey are available out of the pen tonight. This is going to be a smorgasbord of strategy for both teams. Today's sports media went crazy over Joe Maddon's decision to bring closer Aroldis Chapman in early yesterday with a 5-run lead. Essentially, pundits are setting up a we-told-you-so scenario if Chapman blows it tonight. But if Chapman seals the deal, they won't acknowledge it. They'll just act like they never said anything in the first place. Sports media. In other sports news, if that's even a thing, the new-look Chicago Bulls are undefeated with a big road game in Boston tonight. They're looking good, though, on and off the court. Did you see the Bulls posing on Twitter with no shirts on? Lots of tattoos. That's pretty much all I could take away from. The Knicks are in town on Friday, so that'll be the return of D. Noah and Joakim Rose. Wait, is that right? Can't remember their names. It's been so long. Who cares? I mean, we got D-Wade and Rondo now, so we're not sweating it. The Bears got a much-needed win over the Vikings on Monday Night Football, separating them by 2 games from the number one pick next year. So really kind of a loss. But Jay Cutler looked good. We should sign that guy to a long-term contract. What are we waiting for? And rookie running back Jordan Howard was given the NFC Player of the Week honors. The Bears are on a bye week this week. I hate to say it, but the rest of the Bears' schedule, it's winnable. Besides a couple games against the NFC North, like the Lions, Vikings, and Packers, they got a chance to run the table. Now, that's probably not going to happen because it's the Bears, but there's a chance. Imagine this team, 7-9. And finally tonight, Charlie Sheen was denied his request to throw out the first pitch in Cleveland tonight. You know, because he was in the movie Major League, which was sort of the story of a ragtag bunch of baseball players playing for the Cleveland Indians. He was denied because, well, because he's Charlie Sheen. And, well, we all decided it's time for him to just go away. So, thank you, Cleveland. That's the carryout for November 2nd, 2016. It's going to be a stressful night, so we put in some extra salt packets, extra chili pepper, extra napkins, extra soy sauce, and extra wet naps. Because you know what? You're going to need all of it. All right, coming up here, we're going to take a diversion tactic from the Cubs and talk about some more other sports. The Chicago Bears. Doug Plank's going to join us, talk about where the Bears go after their big win on Monday Night Football. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, man?
I am surprised that the Indians organization did not allow the Condor of Calabasas to throw out the first pitch tonight. I'm shocked.
Who did? Did they end up? Was it like just a former player?
You know what?
Like,
I didn't see.
Was it Julio Franco?
I was wrapped up in creating some news.
Joe Carter. Who threw out the first pitch?
I have no idea.
I think it was Tomey.
Was it Tomey?
Okay. Yeah, well, that would make sense.
Yeah, I was going to say, hoping it'd be Charlie Sheen. Whatever.
Who once referred to himself as the Condor of Calabasas.
Yeah, exactly.
Winning.
Well, you know, I'm glad they didn't, obviously, because it's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
I think locally, there's two stories I think of interest right now. One, that the city of Evanston says they're going to play or sound off the weather horns, the emergency horns, if the Cubs win.
Right.
Which, pretty, I know it's game seven, it's a big night, but probably bad since there's thunderstorms in the area.
Uh-huh.
I would think that, you know, old professor reading his book doesn't have a TV or radio. You know, he's just reading his book with his tweed jacket on. Oh, maybe I'll read this in volume. He's like, oh, get to the basement.
Yeah, I'll log on to the medical examiner's website to see if there are any clutch and grabs.
Exactly. And then I forgot the second one, but that's okay. it's going to be good. We play the fight song because maybe there's a little fight left in them. It's 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. The download here. Talking with Doug Plank as we do after every Bears game. This week, the Bears Monday Night Football, they take a win at Soldier Field, which, you know, they haven't been able to do much recently. A 2010 victory over the NFC North leading Minnesota Vikings, their second loss. It was just so disheartening for the Minnesota Vikings that today offensive coordinator Norv Turner resigned. Wow, and I thought it was the Vikings defense that had trouble on Monday night. Doug Plank joins us now. Doug, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing fantastic. Really, I mean, I'm watching that Chicago Bears. Wow, I know the city's on fire about the Cubs, but what the Bears did the other night, I'll tell you, that was very impressive.
What was the most impressive thing for you? I mean, because watching it, we're so sort of stone-cold, unemotional about a 1-6 Bears team. What was it about the Bears that made them look like a winning NFL team?
Well, I'll tell you what. Two things. Jay Cutler, he looked like the quarterback that the Bears were trying to trade for way back a couple years ago. I mean, he was outstanding. And not just what he did on the field. I loved his leadership on the sideline, directing guys. I understand reading articles that he gave a pregame speech, which was very inspirational. I mean, it's amazing what effect a quarterback can have on the team. And he definitely did it. I mean, he was in that game. He was all in, 100%. And the way he threw those balls and moved around in the pocket, you know, the way he executed those screen plays, I got to tell you, I've never seen Jay Cutler run a screen play like he did last, you know, the other night.
What can be, I mean, is it more comfortable, being more comfortable in a Loggins offensive system? Is it the fact that maybe he's hearing footsteps from the backup quarterback's successful play in Brian Hoyer? Is it the fact that, you know, his chips are down and everyone's pretty much written Jay Cutler off? What was the reasoning behind Jay Cutler having such an impressive performance on Monday night?
Justin, we all have pride, and I think that's what it was. It's not about who's behind him or anything like that. I think Jay just felt like, you know what, I'm going to start becoming the quarterback that everybody expected me to. I mean, his quarterback rating was over 100, and the accuracy that he had and just the way he conducted the offense. I mean, his body language was, I thought it was outstanding. I mean, just the way he was, you know, leading the team out there on the field and as well as the sideline. I saw him interact with people on the sideline. I've never seen him do that before. And the whole time here in Chicago, you know, when I would do games there, broadcast in Soldier Field, he'd just go to the sideline, sit on the bench, didn't talk to anybody. I mean, that's not what quarterbacks do. Then he had two guys, I think Alshon Jeffrey and both Jordan Howard. Wow, those guys were unstoppable. I mean, I know they piled up a couple touchdowns, and I think they had almost 300 yards between them. You know, it just wasn't one guy. The defense looked like the Chicago Bears.
It did.
Defense back in the 80s. I mean, they were pressuring, you know, Bradford all night long. Five sacks. Come on. You know, they hit him 9 times. That was outstanding.
Well, let's stay on the offensive side of the ball, and then we'll get to the defense too. Doug Plank on the download here. I'm interested in Jordan Howard, NFC Offensive Player of the Week. It seemed even in last week and the week before, he almost fell out of favor in the way that they're moving. I didn't realize that Jeremy Langford, the starting running back, was healthy. He came in when Jordan Howard got hurt. I mean, is this essentially today? The game we saw on Monday night, does this solidify Jordan Howard as the starting tailback for the Chicago Bears?
I think so. I didn't realize, you know, until after the game, I read something where he piled up 200 yards from the line of scrimmage. And that hadn't been done, you know, since Gale Sayers during his rookie year. So, I mean, it was impressive. And it wasn't as though he was just running in space. I mean, he was running through defenders. I mean, here's the other thing you got to realize. You know, for a while, the Vikings had the best record in the National Football League. And their whole team is based on defense. And, you know, tackling people and running their schemes, not giving big plays. Mm-hmm. I think that's what was so impressive to me. To watch the Chicago Bears go through that Vikings defense like it was a hot knife through butter. I mean, it was amazing. I don't want to try to overblow it, but what they did the other night was very impressive.
Well, the Bears are 2-6. That's not to get a long way to go.
No, I know.
Although I did say just right before the news that, you know, it's a winnable. Unfortunately, it's a winnable schedule as you look ahead. None of the competition that's coming up really strikes any fear in Bears fans' hearts. But let's talk about the defensive side of the ball. The return of Pernell McPhee. He came back. He played a couple of snaps in the Green Bay game, which was a disaster on Thursday night. On Monday night, he came through and he showed in Monday Night Football to John Gruden's and Zutt. They loved him. I mean, Pernell McPhee was the highlight throughout the night.
He was so explosive and strong. I mean, really, what he did along the line of scrimmage, just throwing people around, was outstanding. I mean, just to watch the incredible strength that he had, and Floyd kept up his improvement in terms of coming off the edge, great pass rush, collapsing the pocket. I mean, I felt bad for Bradford after a while. I don't think, you know, that he had much time back in the pocket. No. Like I said, the defense sacked him five times. And, you know, even Hicks, Akeem Hicks, man, oh, man, what – I don't know what he ate before the game or whatever, but that guy came ready to play. I mean, he wasn't doing anything like, you know, doing swim moves and trying to jump around guys. He was just running over people, getting back to the quarterback.
Well, they seemed to put a lot of pressure on the quarterback, and Bradford, he couldn't make decisions, and that helped because the Bears, the one weakness, I would say, the Bears' secondary banged up. Terry Porter got hurt in the game. I don't know what the status is on him, but the point being that they're playing some guys that I mean, I'm like, oh, wow, I don't even know their numbers. I mean, you're at the point where you're like, I don't know what any of these, the sort of practice squad guys that are playing in the Bears' secondary.
You know, it's funny, even, you know, listening to John Gruden the other night, you could tell that some of the names he really hadn't polished up on. You know, he's like, oh, yeah, and here, we got this guy. He just came in. And, you know, so it's an interesting dynamic of how well they played. You know, the key is, though, and I'm not saying this lightly, you know, any team can go out and have a great game. You know, they can go out and surprise somebody and do well and run the ball and play defense and everything like that. I'll tell you, the real key is to try to do it 2 weeks in a row or 3 weeks in a row, because then you're not sneaking up on anybody. You know, they see, they're watching you on film, they know who you are, and now it's a matter of what can you do? Can you do that same thing against another team? And it's like you said, Justin, you know, I think the teams that they got here in the second half of the season are a lot less impressive than they were in the first half. So I would fully expect them to have a better record than 2-6 over these last eight games.
Yeah. Well, the Chicago Bears, obviously at 2-6, they head into their bye week. And as we just said, we're talking with Doug Plank, the former Chicago Bear great safety, number 46. We're talking about a winnable schedule. I mean, the Chicago Bears have, you know, I mean, they got a date with the Buccaneers. They got a date with the Giants. They got the Titans. They still got Lions, Packers, and Vikings, which they've all played competitive with. They beat the Vikings and Lions. They're the Redskins in there somewhere. But the point being that none of these teams are even – may not even be playoff bound in the way that they look.
No.
So is there, I mean, there's a feasible outlook that the Bears could improve and at least make something of this season.
You know what? And it goes back to that old argument, you know, people say, oh, you never played anybody. Listen, you can only play the guys that are the teams that are on your schedule. That's all you can do. And so you need to go out there, and you're right, they're going to play some teams like Tennessee here. I've done a game, you know, broadcast a game this year with Tennessee, and same thing with Tampa. I think that those teams have some weaknesses. You know, they're not as strong as some of the other teams in the league. But the bottom line is, it's just like when you're playing Jacksonville. If you lose to Jacksonville, then who do you go to and say, hey, we're really a good team. We just had a bad day.
Right.
So that's the pressure that's on the Bears, I think, you know, especially coming up next week, you know, when they play the Bucs, you know, the Tampa Bucs. It's going to be a situation where they're expected to dominate and be able to run the ball and stop them and rush the quarterback. And, you know, they just got to make sure that they can maintain some of the same momentum that they've got going right now going into, you know, next week's game.
Okay, so I mentioned at the top of the segment that Norv Turner abruptly resigned as the offensive coordinator. An offensive coordinator who's you know, who hasn't had a – I mean, he's had a tough hand dealt to him. I mean, from Sam Bradford coming over when Teddy Bridgewater, Adrian Peterson's out, hasn't played. He's working with backups. I even think the backup to Adrian Peterson didn't play on Monday Night Football. So what to make of that? I mean, Norv Turner, they threw a stat up that he's been active for 32 years in the NFL.
Wow, you can only imagine his pension, huh? 32 years. Let me just say this about Norv. I think he's a good football coach. Number one, I don't think, this is my take, having been an NFL coach, I don't think coaches resign in the middle of the season. I think someone makes them resign, and they're given no other choice. You know, sometimes when someone knocks on your door early in the morning or late at night, and they say, okay, you got a decision to make. Do you want to resign, or are we going to terminate you here within the next 10 hours or 5 hours or whatever the case might be? So, you know, I'm sure somebody helped walk him to the door with his box of office belongings that they had on his desk. And, you know, I think that they were very embarrassed. They were very embarrassed by what the Bears had done to them.
That's amazing.
And as I said,
I mean, do you see that often? I mean, to see, I mean, to be a, I mean, that's only their, what, their second loss of the season? I mean,
right.
The Bears are 2-6 and all their coaches are fine. I mean, what was it about losing a second game?
You know, the Vikings played like the Bears had played earlier this year. Yeah. You know, it looked like there was no emotion, there was no effort, there was no team camaraderie. I didn't see a lot of people excited about being there. I mean, this was a national televised game. Everybody in the country was watching this game, and you don't need anything else as a player just to say, okay, I'm excited, I'm fired up, I'm ready to go. And to go out there and play the way they did, I mean, it was embarrassing. I was embarrassed for them. And you would have completely thought, if you didn't know which team had the worst record, you would have thought the Bears, you know, had the dominating record, and the Vikings were the last place team in the division.
I'm interested in, as we wrap up, you know, Doug, I'm interested in John Fox as he continues to develop and evolve as the Bears coach. He's in year two. You know, besides a Thursday night loss against the Packers, which really arguably with Brian Hoyer going down and going to Matt Barkley, I mean, that was the worst case scenario for the Bears. But, I mean, he beat the Lions, a Lions team that seems to be somewhat rejuvenated, even though I think they're 500. He beat a Vikings team on Monday Night Football. I mean, are you seeing when he has to play the same teams the next year improvement, meaning Vic Fangio and John Fox are learning to beat the competition that's in the division?
You know, I really, you know, everybody says in football, you are what your record says you are.
Yeah.
And right now the team is 2-6. So regardless of how good they looked in this last game, I mean, the bottom line is if John Fox has another great game at the end of these next eight games where he finishes the final game of the regular season looking like he did against the Vikings, and it was for his second win of the back half of the season, making him 4-10 or 12, you know, it's not going to be good. I mean, you know, the way you're evaluated is over a course of the whole season, not just one game. And as I said before, you know, now that they played so outstanding in this game, I'm telling you, teams are not going to take them lightly. Whether it's doing extra weightlifting during the week, practicing a little bit harder, staying out there a little bit longer, you know, just trying to work on who you're going to go against, all those things are going to start happening against the Chicago Bears now. So they really better be ready to start defending what they just did here the other night. I mean, that was impressive. But, you know, in the NFL, you can't do it just one week. You got to do it over and over and over again.
Doug Plank, the former Chicago Bear great safety, good old number 46, and an analyst for the NFL and other. It talks to us every Monday here on the Download or after a Bears game. They played Monday night. We did a show last night. So we got a week off. We'll catch up to you after the Bears beat the Bucks. Thanks for joining us, buddy.
Justin, sounds good. Yep, thank you so much.
Welcome back to the Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest has written a new book which takes on a pretty minuscule topic, the future of civilization. Not much to see here. More specifically, the future of our cities. Jonathan F.P. Rose's new book is called The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life. In the book, Rose lays out a vision for what we need to do to prepare for issues like climate change, income inequality, aging, housing, and pretty much a ton more, I did not even mention. The great part of the book is that Rose looks to the past to find solutions for the future. Jonathan F.P. Rose is my guest tonight at the big table. Jonathan, thanks for being here.
Justin, so great to be here with you.
All right, let's talk about this. I mean, this is interesting because I really do feel like a lot of the book is about looking to the past to engage and to inform the future.
Right. My goal is actually even to inspire the future, because many of the world's earliest cities were quite inspirational. They had big visions. They had huge visions for what they wanted to become. And I've actually seen that part of what leads to the better or less success of cities today is how big is their vision for themselves.
So visions. I mean, and you talk about in the book, too, as I mentioned in the headline, the idea of modern science and also just our human makeup as a society. But one of the things that is tough is for us to be able to look long term and be able to see some of these problems and fix them when we're dealing with problems in the short term.
Right. One of the reasons to look to the past is because we can look at long term as it occurred through the past. And one of the things you see is that there are very, very few cities that have predominance for more than 200, 300, 400 years. They all rise and fall. But the other thing about the future is with big data, we now actually have the ability to take an enormous amount of information coming at us simultaneously from cities. So we could look at traffic information, housing information, environmental impacts, climate change, health information, educational attainment, all the things that we may aspire for to make a better city. And we can actually look at the things we're doing, the interventions we're doing, and in real time see where we're going, do scenario planning and long-range strategic plans. So we have better control over cities than we ever had before.
Is that something we're going to use? And I also would just ask curiously, I mean, does it make that a better outcome for what might be in the future than some of the ancient civilizations where they didn't have access to computers and data and things of that nature? Some of the situations turned out pretty well.
In many cases, they did turn out well because they had a big vision and they actually had a sense of purpose. Early cities were all formed around a temple, and that temple's purpose was to align humans and nature. It was to be, and they're often on what they considered sacred spots.
Yeah.
And so there was to be really this nexus of harmony. In fact, in the Chinese cities, the harmony was an implicit responsibility of the emperor and a key to the design of the cities. Having that larger purpose, they were always attuned to, are we getting more in harmony with nature or less? And that is something we are not doing today.
And it's not just lip service, because you talked about in the book, just even at the beginning, the concept that populations in urban landscapes here in this country, around the world, are exploding. I mean, they used went from, I can't remember the numbers, but it's just like 70-75% in years.
So we were, the global population was 1 billion in 1900. And by 2050, it's supposed to stabilize at about 10 billion. The population is also becoming more prosperous. The good thing is people around the world are moving out of poverty, but they're consuming a lot more, and that creates a big resource demand. And obviously, they pollute more as they consume more. We're seeing a rise in income inequality, and the world is rapidly urbanizing. So 80% of the world's population is moving to cities. What you're seeing is what we learned from history is that when you have climate change, large population growth, overconsumption of resources, and income inequality, when the climate changes, as it did naturally throughout time, you often had collapse. You almost always had collapse, because the climate change typically would bring things like drought, and cities often grew to the very edge of their resources, say their water supply. So if you design a city for 1 million people and the water supply can only supply 800,000 or 700,000 because of a drought, those 200,000 people who all of a sudden are not being taken care of, if it's an unequal society and there is not a sense of altruism that reaches down and takes care of everybody, they revolt.
There's something to be said about all the things you just mentioned are a part of the current recipe of how we live. Are planners, yourself, others, leaders, are we looking to history and we looking and saying, oh, we're at the point where we stretch resources to the edge?
There are many thinkers who are saying that. But the day-to-day urban planners, I don't see it happening. I mean, I should rephrase that. There's a growing sense of resilience. But in most cities, the day-to-day urban planners are so overwhelmed with the issues of current needs of affordable housing and all the zoning applications and all the neighborhood issues that they often don't have time to step back and really think big. And when they do, we're seeing cities do plans like 2030 plans, 2020 plans. Mm-hmm. So these are 15, 20, 25 years maybe in advance. But we're not seeing people, the cities do 2100 plans or plans to 2200.
I can't even imagine. I think this is important to say. I mean, you talk about urban life. And someone who might be listening right now, say, in the western suburbs or someone even in McHenry County, say, well, you know, the cities, they're going to have problems, not us out here. That's not what you're talking about. You're talking about urbanizing in the way that that includes a region, not just the city, but the suburbs, everything included.
Exactly. I use the word city because it's a more – it's easier one to read and say. But in fact, we mean metropolitan regions. And there are many interesting things happening in the suburbs. The first is there is now more suburban poverty in America than urban poverty. In fact, urban conditions are getting better and better. More reinvestment in city. There's jobs are coming back to cities. Suburban areas – many suburban areas, not all, are actually having a tougher time. The second thing is that we are seeing an urbanization of the suburbs. We're seeing the growth of town centers, particularly around train station stops, where there were traditionally town centers.
You see that here all over Chicago.
And what we're seeing is that younger families really want to be located in those town centers. They want to be walk to the great restaurants and down, all the amenities of downtowns. Mm-hmm. We're seeing around the country much more multifamily housing being built in those centers. So the ones that actually can create a walkable, mixed-income, mixed-use center with transit in the middle of it are thriving. The ones that are steeped in enormous traffic and are disparate and don't have a sense of place are often, not in every case, but often not doing as well.
So much to talk about. Let's take a break. We'll come back and we'll start with the past. I'm interested in how some of these civilizations were able to tackle the same problems that we're tackling today. Jonathan F.P. Rose is the author of The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life. He's my guest at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in the studio, he is the author of The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life, Jonathan F.P. Rose. I really want to talk about the city ecosystem, the concept of where cities came from. I mean, as we look back in human civilization, you think that everything is either caves or strange, like you said, almost like organized around temple, but not really how we know cities to be today, and that's completely false. There were a lot of cities and urban environments at the beginnings of human civilization.
So what was interesting is the very first buildings were actually temples, and that's and there were some amazing, huge temples with incredible sculptures, and they may not have even been huts at that time, but people got together to build these temples. And then they began building towns, and the towns were often gathered around a temple. And as technology advanced and people began to create more interesting things, they began to trade with each other. If everybody had the same thing, there's nothing to trade.
Right.
And the trade formed what actually archaeologists at University of Chicago call an interaction zone. So you began to get this network effect of connectivity. And as there's more trade, there's more prosperity, more people moving to these towns, and the towns began to grow. So the emergence of the city wasn't a single phenomenon like all of a sudden there's one great city. It was this network phenomena where throughout the Middle East, more and more towns grew. They were trading. They're actually trading across distances.
And that's that I think the area wasn't necessarily just one city, but the area, the Ubaid, that's the first, as we know it, of human civilization where it became almost like a city.
Well, so that, and so these towns grew larger and larger, and then they came with what they called proto-cities. But then the first real city was called Ubaid, and it was about 3200 BC. And there are models. You can actually go online and see models of it. And it was built out of stone and substantial buildings and palaces and temples, and it was a real significant city. And by the mid 2500s BCs in the Middle East, 90% of the people lived actually in cities. Mm. There were huge, I call cities cauldrons of opportunity. People move to cities because they think their lives can be better there.
You know, as you mentioned in the first segment about the idea that resources got stretched thin as cities got bigger and bigger and got towards the edges. For a place like Ubaid, were they dealing with the same issues we're dealing with today when you talk about climate change, obviously building in the desert, talking about income inequality and the other issues that big cities in this country and around the world are dealing with?
That's part of human nature, and they did have to deal with them. But they were actually, interestingly, although they had very wealthy, they had emperors and people who led them, but they were fairly equal. And the way we know this is because the house sizes were pretty much the same. And this is a really interesting thing, is that people are very sensitive to fairness in cities and whether the system is fair or not. And the original temples were actually also the storehouses. They were the places that people trusted to bring their grain and their precious things to store, and that they would be safe kept and fairly redistributed. And people understood that fair redistribution meant you didn't always get back all that you put in. It was to take care of the whole society. As a matter of fact, in 1752 BC, Hammurabi, who's the head of Babylonia, a vast empire, and he has the first real code we know, the Code of Hammurabi. And one of the key lines is, he said, my job is to oversee the fair distribution of goods, to protect the weak from the strong, to protect the widows and orphans, to see that justice is done throughout the land, and to provide for the welfare of all of mankind.
Well, there's something to be said about
human civilization and the struggle, and there have been different names, as you just mentioned there, but different names of the concept of socialism versus capitalism, this concept of we need to protect everybody and make sure it's fair, as opposed to I'm going to get mine and we're going to build and I'm going to get wealthy off of this. This is not something that is happening just here in Chicago or New York City, but this is something that goes all the way, dates back to B.C. time.
As I said, people move to cities for opportunity, and opportunity is a me thing. It's about I want to make my world better, my family better, grow my wealth. But cities thrive because of we-ness. There is a fantastic, originally Chicago-based sociologist named Robert Sampson who compared all the neighborhoods of Chicago, and he said there's a factor called collective efficacy, and you can actually track the prosperity of neighbors and compare to this factor. And collective efficacy is the ability of people to work together to achieve a communal outcome. And it's not only the achieving the outcome, it's the belief that if you work together, you will succeed. So we know that the communities in which there's a sense that we're all in it together ultimately are much more resilient and thrive much better in times of crises. So, for example, the Mayan civilization. So here we're, you know, now in the early 500, 600, 700 AD, and fantastic civilization is growing, but it was very unequal. And when climate change hit and its water resources shrunk, the people who were this not only just the slaves, the people who the society was not taking well care of, felt abused and about the unfairness of the distribution of goods, and they burnt the civilization down in revolt.
It's such a fascinating look at the way that we live as humans, but also just about urban planning and long term. You think about one of the things that I, as we switch to a more current time, you think of the way that American cities were built, and you think of New York City or Philadelphia, but even 500 years before that, 400 years, and people never talk about the Iroquois in the city that they called Cahokia, which is now St. Louis, was the first major city in the United States.
There were actually vast Native American cities in the United States, quite extensive. They had a much more urban culture, and we destroyed it. One of the things that happened is the Europeans brought diseases with them, and so many of the populations before the Europeans really got there, the populations had already died from smallpox. They didn't fully understand what was here.
There's so much in this book, so much to talk about. Let's take a break and an update on tonight's news. When we come back, I'd love to talk about how we as a nation view cities in our lifetimes, in the 20th century, 21st century. There's a lot that happened that really almost goes against some of the concepts we were just talking about the idea of collective we, and some that actually went with the concept. We'll talk more with Jonathan F.P. Rose. He's the author of The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life. We'll be back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest at the big table tonight, Jonathan F.P. Rose. He's the author of The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life. Talking about learning from our past to inform and inspire the future. When you talk about urban planning and we talk about cities and urban life, you know, you can look to how it is today based on how some of the policies and I guess politics that went into it even in the early 20th century. Why don't we start with I'm interested in 1922, Herbert Hoover. He was really into urban planning. It's surprising, but he was really into it, and he really wanted to push the idea of zoning.
So he was actually the Department of Commerce then. He had not yet become president, and he loved the idea of zoning. And he actually wrote something about how it'll make our cities healthier and environmentally better, and I appreciate his appreciation of planning. And the federal government then put out a lot of incentives that required and encouraged states to all adopt the same zoning code, and then the states passed that on to the cities. So cities were not zoned before, and there are some very good reasons to protect. So if you lived in a nice residential area and all of a sudden somebody put in a factory, and remember the factories back then were highly polluting, that would destroy your property values, and that would be something you would not like. So zoning was a way to control it. But zoning went too far, because it created a whole series of single-use zones. So we said all the factories are going to be here, all the single-family houses are going to be here, all the multifamily housing is going to be here. And what it, in fact, what makes cities great is that everything's all woven together.
Yeah, it's mixed, right.
There's a huge amount of complexity. That's what draws people to cities. And the zoning at that point was so single-use, it segregated the elements and began in many ways to not only tear the city apart, but to restrict their evolution. So if you had an area that was zoned manufacturing and manufacturing began to decline, as, by the way, what happened in most Midwestern cities
including here,
the United States, including here, the zoning wouldn't allow something else to take place. The zoning also concentrated pollution.
It also concentrated wealth in a way because you'd have zoning for certain types of buildings. And they were luxury high-rises, and that's what we see a lot of, what we see maybe in the Gold Coast here. But you also – a lot of zoning – was manufacturing, and that kept, you know, developers to be able to come in and say, I'm going to add some wealth to this area, because they couldn't.
Exactly. Then a second overlay. In the Depression comes, and in the 1930s, the federal government, to try and encourage home building and home ownership and get the economy back, creates the Federal Housing Authority and starts creating mortgage programs. But the mortgage programs came with an inherent zoning of its own, a racist zoning, in fact. And there were five different colors, the different neighborhoods. So there were maps of every city in America. And a neighborhood that was circled in blue, you put your mortgages here, it's a great place. And there was yellow, green, but there was also red. And neighborhoods that were redlined, that had a red around them.
Yeah, we just talked about that on the show, yeah.
The government actually said, you should not lend here. And those were all, first of all, minority neighbors, they're immigrant neighborhoods, they're actually even Jewish and Italian neighborhoods. So those homeowners couldn't get mortgages, so they couldn't invest in improving their homes. People couldn't borrow to buy in those neighborhoods.
What I love about this is, I mean, we learn from history, and we'd go all the way back to BC time, and there was talk about how you develop a city and how everybody lives together in a collective we. And it's almost through politics and policy and the federal government that over time we've seen that deteriorate.
The federal government is not all bad, by the way. Yeah. I think it does many wonderful things, too. But what we need are cities that are much more dynamic and that are thriving and have the ability to create opportunity. I actually want to talk about that. And so when you took the zoning and then you took the really racially motivated housing, so if you had a community that housing finance, if you had a community that was restricted by zoning and then people couldn't borrow money to improve, of course that neighborhood was going to decline.
And, you know, we'll fast forward a little bit. I mean, obviously the beginning of public housing was tremendously political.
Right.
The concept was to make a mixed income community, and it was a Republican Congress that said, no, this is just for poor people.
Yeah, so interestingly, the idea of public housing came out of Europe where it was very mixed income. And so that got proposed. And by the way, there was a very important Republican Senator, Robert Taft, who proposed it too. But the home builders, the suburban home builders, the suburban mortgage brokers, the suburban realtors all got together and they said, we don't want the federal government building middle income housing because every time somebody would live in that, they wouldn't buy a home.
Yeah, there's and that capitalism, socialism stuff, right?
Well, it's not, you know, It's not capitalism and socialism because I run a for-profit company. I'm a believer that capitalism.
All right, get out, Mr. Rudnow.
I believe that capitalism can do a lot of good things, but in this case, it's lobbying. It's actually lobbying that is the issue. The power of the lobby is so distorted that the Republican Congress said we will only support federally public housing if it is purely for low-income people. Because anybody could be a customer we don't want to serve.
And at the same time gave mortgage tax.
At the same time gave all these great mortgage benefits.
Right.
Also only the suburbs. They were actually designed so they didn't work in cities. So all of a sudden you had this unbalance where, in effect, the only federal programs for poor people was public housing, and it concentrated them. And we know how negatively that did to Chicago.
It gets glossed over when it comes to what we had here, which was white flight, which was in the 50s. It was after this where there were incentives for people of middle income and the middle class to leave cities to move to suburbs.
So there are tremendous economic incentives to leave. Like you get a mortgage, which you couldn't get in the city. And there was this concentration of poverty. We now know that mixing incomes really leads to the healthiest communities. But there was another reason people left, and that was the urban school systems began to decline.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that. Right.
So what's interesting is in Finland has the best educational outcomes in the world. And the way they do it is every school is equal, whether it's the wealthiest neighborhood or the poorest neighborhood, the most Finnish or the most immigrant neighborhood, the outcomes are the same. The school might be different because they have to adjust to different circumstances. The teachers are superbly trained.
How do you do that when we just talked about the construct of, you know, lobbying and the construct of making money versus the royal we? How do you do that? How does Finland still be able to do that with all those forces that are at play in the world?
There's an example in the book of Louisville, Kentucky. So this is actually a really interesting one. It's a comparison of Louisville and Detroit. So 1970, the courts, federal courts rule there has to be a busing and a school integration. And I compare two cities. So Detroit at that time was 80% white, 20% black. The people revolted. The John Birch Society actually burnt school buses. People moved out to the suburbs in droves. There are many reasons why Detroit collapsed, but that was certainly didn't help. And today Detroit is 96% minority. And as we know, Detroit's actually coming back, a very interesting example, but had a failing school system. Louisville, Kentucky, a southern city, actually took the opposite approach. Due to leadership of the Bingham family that owned the newspaper and the radio and TV stations, and the Brown family that owned the largest employer, Brown Foreman, they said, we're all in this together. So this is real civic corporate leadership. And they combined the city and the county school district, so you couldn't move to the county to get away from the schools. And then everybody was this all in it together. So then everybody had a mutual interest in making every school equally as good. Now, they're not all perfect. They're not all equally equal, but they're much, much better. They started making magnet schools and spreading them equally around. There are now parents who want their kids bused to the inner city best school. And it worked so well that they eventually merged the city and county government. They merged everything. And that whole region is all one. It has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country. And the reason why is employers come there and say, these graduates of the school system are superbly educated to be employed for the future.
Jonathan F.P. Rose is the author of The Well-Tempered City. He's my guest. We got about 5 minutes left. And I do want to talk about the five tentpoles for the book. I mean, there really is this. The book is about looking at the problems and what can be the solutions. So let's go over them. I got a sheet here that's got circularity, resilience, community, compassion, and coherence. Why don't we start with coherence?
All right. Coherence, we've talked a lot about segmentation. It's about integrating everything. It's about having, a great vision. And Chicago was one of the first cities in the 20th century to have a great vision, the 1909 Burnham Plan. And by the way, that plan wasn't done by government. It was done by a group of private citizens and business people who pulled it together. So having a great vision and then figuring out how to integrate city departments and programs rather than have them work against each other to achieve that vision.
Not unlike what we just talked about with the idea of we're all in it together, like what's happening in Louisville. All right, circularity.
So circularity is realizing that everything is interconnected. Most cities, actually, if you track them, 98% of the stuff that comes into them leaves as waste within 6 months. So how can we capture that, recycle it? San Francisco has the highest recycling rate in the world, 80%. That actually creates local jobs, reduces pollution. And remember I said the world's going to have a resource crunch coming. It even has in some places. Makes cities more resource independent. And we can take a lot of waste and make construction materials out of it, recycle water and make fresh drinking water.
And it's beyond the concept of recycling saves the planet. This is really about recycling saving the city in the way that we're going to need to do that as resources get strapped.
And it creates jobs, too. So it's a real win-win.
All right, let's keep moving. Resilience.
Okay, so resilience, we know there are many threats. The world is going to be much more volatile in the 21st century. We saw from the economic crisis, we need economic resilience. But from the human-caused climate change, temperatures are going to rise, sea levels are going to rise, disease vectors, we're going to be seeing Zika everywhere, all due to climate change. Resilience is the adaptive capacity of a city. What's amazing about nature is it has incredible adaptive capacity. If there's a forest fire, nature completely knows how to rebuild itself, you know, to grow back and become a thriving forest again. The cities that are more resilient, and there are a lot of characteristics of resilience, are the ones that do the best. Interestingly, there's not only physical resilience, and we need clean energy systems, smart grids, a whole bunch of things, but there's also social resilience. And one of the best examples happened in 1995 when there was a great heat wave in Chicago, and over 700 people died. a sociologist named Eric Kleinenberg mapped that. And what he discovered was that the wealthy white neighborhoods did better than the poor black neighborhoods. But Auburn Gresham did as well as the wealthy white neighbors because of very strong social networks. We've seen that strong social networks and a sense of mutuality, when you look at the great earthquake in San Francisco, et cetera, communities have a sense of mutuality during times of stress, are much more resilient.
All right, community. That's a nice little tie into community.
So community. So what we've learned is that people thrive in communities. I talked earlier about collective efficacy. Communities need seven characteristics to really function. They need affordable housing. They need a great education system, which we talked about, great distributed health care. They need healthy food, and it's great to see that the fresh, the Whole Foods just opened
up in Inglewood.
Exactly. They need diverse transit systems, multiple ways of getting to multiple places, and they need local jobs. They need arts and culture, and they actually need places of spirituality, places for people to reflect. And remember that original role of the temple was to give us a bigger perspective as to who we all are and how we can get there together, vision.
All right, and the last one, compassion.
Right. So what we've learned is that altruism is actually, from an evolutionary point of view, a protective factor, that the tribes that are just always fighting each other and others that say that fail, and the ones in which people collaborate, that's actually what led to human civilization advancement, is our ability to hunt together, to farm together, to grow. Irrigation. Irrigation ditches and systems are the oldest continuously operating democratic form where people decide to how to fairly distribute water. So I'm a big believer in individual entrepreneurialism, but it must be in balance with altruism and the sense that we're all in it together. And you can see that from a lot of science, from a lot of history, and just from the way we feel that when we work together, that's what really makes cities thrive.
It's a fascinating book, The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life. Thank you so much, Jonathan F.P. Rose, for being my guest tonight on The Big Table.
Justin, it's great to be here.
Chicago Cubs in a commercial break here. Game 7, the World Series. Looks as Kyle Hendricks comes out of the game with two outs in the bottom of the fifth, correct? And that means he is out of the game. And in comes the bald eagle. John Lester comes in out of the pen to deal with the Cleveland Indians. Carlos Santana on first base after a walk, which the umpire missed a called third. In that case, but he walks Hendricks out, Lester in. The Cubs right now with a 5-1 lead in the bottom of the fifth inning. They're hoping to close out the Indians in this frame. And it looks like John Lester is going to take us to Aroldis Chapman. You like that move? You're the resident Cubs fan, Pete Zimmerman. You want to spout off like Around the Horn did today? Or
I don't like it.
You don't like it? Why don't you like it? You just think Hendricks is pitching well.
Yeah, I think he's pitching well. They're up by three.
Four.
5-1, yeah, four. Yeah. Lester just pitched, you know, what, Monday?
He also comes in with an inherited runner on first who will arguably take second on the first pitch, right, because of the...
I assume Ross is in there and Contreras is out.
I believe so. I haven't seen if that's happened yet, but Ross had been suited up to catch, and he is John Lester's catcher. And Wilson Contreras' night may be over as well. We'll give you that in just a second here. Yes, it looks like it. David Ross has entered the game as well. So Wilson Contreras, who had a huge double off the wall, is out of the World Series, as well as Kyle Hendricks. John Lester, David Ross in. You know, I mean, if you can have a Cy Young, arguably the Cy Young Award winner at this point, John Lester, who is in contention, but and second, the runner up, probably Kyle Hendricks.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you're in a position where you can run two candidates for the Cy Young at the Cleveland Indians in Game 7, as well as a closer like Aroldis Chapman. You're in a pretty good position up four in the fifth. We got to go to Ryan Burroughs at some point. Ryan's in Wrigleyville.
Yeah.
And I've been seeing on Twitter the lines and the bars are starting to balloon, if you will.
I think he's at Murphy's.
Is he? I would have picked I don't know, I would have picked Deuces, Sluggers, maybe a Houndstooth. I would have varied it up a little bit. So, I mean, I think one of the storylines that I find interesting is that the Cubs didn't do a watch party at Wrigley.
Right.
And I've heard a couple of things, and actually the only source I really saw that was sort of definitive was I believe a vendor who emailed or messaged into our Facebook page that said the reason is that the Ricketts said we want our vendors and team and personnel to be able to enjoy the game. I don't know if that's true or not.
That's nice.
Is what he said.
Yeah.
It's nice, but I also would counter that that's good money for a person who is a vendor at Wrigley Field who is not going to work again until April. If you open up the concessions and they're tipping and things, I would assume someone who's you know, is behind the beer thing or you know, shelling out hot dogs is okay with the fact that they got to work one more night. Because that was a big thing when there was strike and there was talk about basketball, the lockout, that the United Center vendors were not going to get an opportunity, you know? So, yeah, I don't know why they didn't do it.
I was at, you know, we went on Sunday. We didn't have tickets to the game, but we went to the neighborhood to just kind of walk around, soak up the atmosphere, take a picture of Harry Carey holding an apple, the Harry Carey statue holding an apple, you know, things of that nature.
Sure.
And
as one does.
There were so many police officers there. I mean, it was incredible. And most of them were just, like, sitting around smoking cigars.
They were there, right?
BSing. And I was like, why are they all there? It seems like overkill, you know, sucking up overtime, whatever.
And
but
you
then,
wonder, what was the but then?
Well, I was thinking that, like, well, if, you know, if something horrible happens,
They're there.
You needed that
presence.
There's
got to be some sort of formula used by the police when it comes to crowd control. And if there's this many people in an area, you're expecting this, how many officers. I haven't heard too much of drawing a correlation between the huge numbers of violence, the uptick this weekend. We saw 57 shootings and 14 deaths on a non-holiday weekend. If that has anything to do with the fact that the Chicago police had to monitor Wrigley Field in the Wrigleyville neighborhood and
redistribution
put many more, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if there have been articles about that or not. But you wonder. There's only a finite amount of police officers, and I would think that. You know, they're pretty busy on the weekend with other things when there isn't a Cubs playoff game or a World Series game.
For sure.
So maybe that has something to do with it. All right, coming up, we're going to talk with Kevin Allison from The State. He's got a podcast. He's coming to the Chicago Podcast Festival. Also, Iman Loren, who is the Chicago Youth Poet Laureate, who was a champion from Louder Than a Bomb. We're going to talk with her as well. And, of course, coming up at 10 o'clock, we'll have postgame on World Series Game 7. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, coming up the weekend of the 18th is the inaugural Chicago Podcast Festival. It's going to feature podcasts produced and performed live on stage. For some, that might be a terrifying experience, but not for Kevin Allison. Kevin will be bringing his popular show, Risk, True Tales Boldly Told, to the festival. If you haven't heard it, it's a storytelling podcast where storytellers, comedians, artists, they all tell embarrassing personal stories. Comedian Kevin Allison has been doing the show live in L.A. and New York monthly since 2009, and the podcast includes some of those stories and some others. Allison is one of the comedians from the groundbreaking sketch comedy ensemble The State, which was founded at NYU and ran back on MTV in the mid-90s. Kevin Allison lives in New York, and he joins us on the line. Kevin, thanks for taking some time out. We appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about Risk. I mean, there's so many great storytelling shows that we have here in town and also, you know, that obviously are in New York and L.A. What differentiates Risk from the other shows that are doing the same thing?
When I started it in 2009, I realized that there were a couple of very popular storytelling shows that were very deliberately making their content the sort of thing that you could play on family-friendly radio. Mm-hmm. and I wanted to create a show where people could talk about attempting murder or trying the very kinkiest sex they've ever had or something traumatic that happened to them in their childhood. I wanted people to be able to speak with no censorship and really talk the way that they would talk to their therapist or their best friend, not worrying about being politically correct or, you know, not worrying about language or anything like that. So on Risk, nothing is taboo. And we always say that the title of the series itself is kind of like a trigger warning because You can go from a story being absolutely outrageously hilarious to a story that is just, you know, your jaw drops right. And you can't believe how traumatic it is. So there is nowhere that we fear to tread on risk.
Well, for you, I mean, you were a stand-up comedian. I mean, you did sketch comedy as well. What about storytelling drew you in? What was it about doing a show like this live monthly that drew you in as a comedian?
You know, I had done sketch comedy characters up on stage for so many years. First with my comedy group, The State. We had a series on MTV. And then after that, I never really did pure stand-up comedy, the kind of, you know, observational comedy Jerry Seinfeld would do. I was always getting up on stage as crazy characters. And it was in 2009 that Michael Ian Black, who was another member of The State, he said to me after seeing one of my shows, he said, "Look, you are so fascinating and your life is so insane. I think the audience really just wants you to drop the act. Get rid of the mask and start telling us the truth about your life." And I said, "Oh my God, that would just be way too risky." And he said, "That's the word." He said, "If it feels risky, then it's probably the sort of thing that's going to make people want to lean forward and hear more about."
Right, right.
So the very next week I came back to New York City and I said, "All right, I'll get up on stage and try telling a story about the first time I prostituted myself." And I was 23 years old. And lo and behold, it was like night and day. I was like, wow, the energy between me and that audience was so different when I was getting real. When I was terrified about how much I was revealing, suddenly there was this real resonance between me and the audience. And I said, I want to create a show now where everyone getting up on that stage is revealing something that they're outside their comfort zone talking about. And let's see what happens.
Well, there's something to that. I mean, even as comedians, I mean, like you said, doing characters or even stand-up comedians, they're in effect, they are playing a character. I mean, is it difficult for you as a comedian, a trained comedian who was on the stage, to break out of that and be open and be real and be exposed like that?
It is. I mean, you know, it's weird because what I've found over the years is that you can keep on taking off masks. You know what I mean? Once you reveal something about one part of yourself, you think to yourself, like, you know, a year later, "Oh, yeah, but I've never talked about this other thing I've done." Or, "Everyone thinks I'm such a happy, joyous guy. I've never really gotten into, you know, how I've dealt with depression and anxiety." You know what I mean? We're such layered people that you think, "Oh, I only have a limited amount of stories," but it's not true. And you can keep peeling that onion.
Kevin Allison is my guest tonight. He does the podcast Risk, True Tales Boldly Told. It's both a live show and a podcast, and it'll be at the Chicago Podcast Festival the weekend of the 18th here in Chicago. I mean, it's one thing for you to have that light bulb moment to be able to have that energy and tension with the audience by telling your real stories. How do you get your celebrity friends, other storytellers, and others to go there with you, to be able to drop their act and be able to get real?
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating. When the show started in 2009, it was other comedians and celebrities that I knew from back in the day that I invited to come on and do it. And for them, it was really just a lot of poking and prodding of, "Come on, don't fall back on your usual stuff," you know? And when some of them started to get it, then I could point to that. I could say, "Hey, look what Marc Maron did. He really, like, confessed to some stuff here." And people would be like, "Oh, okay, I guess I got to do that." But what then started happening was people started listening to the podcast and emailing us and saying, "Hey, you know, I was molested when I was a kid," or, "Oh my gosh, I had this bizarre spiritual experience on LSD," or whatever it is. And they wanted to tell, you know, just ordinary listeners wanted to tell their stories. And really, that's when things went to another level. When the people who were passionate listening to the show, people who might have no experience whatsoever getting up in front of an audience, when they started sharing, it really gave a whole new depth to it. So, for example, when we're coming to Chicago, we just announce on the podcast for months ahead of time, "Hey, we're coming to Chicago on November 18th. The theme that night is Frenzy. So if you have a story, I'm at kevin@risk-show.com, and people will write in crazy stories, and then we start investigating. Then I start working like a therapist.
I was going to say, that was my next question. are there some stories, Kevin, that you're like, yeah, that's not going to work. That might be too much, or that might be too real.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's never something that's, you know, for example, oh my gosh, someone pitched us a story once in Chicago one year that was so dramatic. It was kind of a murder sort of story. But then a family member stepped in and said, you know, like oftentimes it'll be a family member that says, you can't share that on that podcast, you know? So as far as territories, there's never territory that we won't go. But we are very aware that we don't want people coming on the podcast to lash out at someone. You know, someone will sometimes right. come on and be like, I just want to talk about what a jackass my former husband was.
Right,
and you'll
right.
be like, well, okay, but if you can also talk about your own flaws and, like, see the better side of who your husband also was, you know, that sort of thing. But if a person seems to be coming with just anger, then we'll shy away from that sort of thing.
Obviously, there's one thing to have a compelling, you know, real sort of, you know, embarrassing story or story about their life. But it's another to tell that story. I mean, how much do you have to, I don't want to say coach, but how much do you have to vet to make sure that someone knows how to put a beginning, middle, and end together to entertain an audience up on stage?
Yeah, quite a lot, actually. You know, the thing of it is, and even with stand-up comedians, even with people who are quite
right.
used to being on stage, because it's not just riffing on a theme. You have to really think a story through and make sure that there is an emotional trajectory that moves from a beginning into a middle and then arrive somewhere at the end. So, yes, I actually teach. I have a school as well. It's at thestorystudio.org. And so I lead people through this all the time, even in corporate environments. You know, we've taught workshops at Google and Citibank, places like that. And it's really just a matter of kind of holding someone's hand, asking them a lot of questions, and then giving them a lot of feedback of, hey, you might leave that part out, but tell us a little bit more about your mom, mm-hmm, here, mm-hmm. you know, and help them shape it.
You can go to a lot of storytelling shows that will be here in Chicago. The idea is you put your name in a hat and they maybe pull out the name and you get up on stage. And that could go one way or another for an audience. I mean, there's not a lot of vetting where you're like, yeah, this story, you know, I wish I would have got up and got a beer at this point. But, I mean, for you, I mean, you have three or four storytellers that come up. I mean, it really is a much more curated experience.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So what you're talking about is a story slam. That's where it's kind of like an open mic thing, where people put their names in the hat. But Risk is something where it's all been very pre-thought out, and we've worked with the storyteller beforehand.
For you as a sketch comedian, do you like this form? I mean, if you look back now, you've been doing it for, you know, 7 years now. I mean, do you like this kind of experience, this kind of show, the storytelling atmosphere, as opposed to what you were doing with sketch comedy?
I love it for a couple of reasons. One, I can be very silly. You know, I can't, within the context of a true story, you can almost go anywhere that your personality wants to go. So if I wanted to bring in a really kooky character, I could. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I have this freedom that I didn't have back in sketch comedy to get really, really serious or really emotional. Like, there's really no limits to the sort of emotional territory you can venture into with this kind of storytelling. So I love it for that. What I found is that, yes, our funny stories, people love them and quote them, and it's great within the context of an evening to have some great laughs. You know, that's a big release for people. But it's usually the sadder or the more shocking ones that people can't get out of their head, you know, that people are talking about years later.
Kevin Allison's going to be at the inaugural Chicago Podcast Festival with his podcast Risk, True Tales, Boldly Told, a very popular podcast that you can find on iTunes and pretty much everywhere else at the Chicago Podcast Festival website. It'll be on November 18th. Kevin Allison, of course, comedian from the sketch comedy ensemble The State, and also the host of this show, both on stage and the podcast. Kevin, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to us tonight. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's Download here on 720 WGN. Coming up, we're going to talk with Iman Loren, who is the Chicago Youth Poet Laureate. She was a champion at Louder Than the Bomb, and she is now a rising star. People paying attention. She was just mentioned in the Chicago Magazine, Young People to Watch. She's, what, 19, 20 years old. We'll talk with her coming up here after the news. Right now, the Cubs and Indians still playing in the seventh inning, top of the seventh inning. Once that game concludes, we will bring you True Blue Playoff Plus. Andy Mazur and Adam Hoge will be in studio. Kevin Powell, Mark Carmen will be out in Cleveland. We also have Ryan Burroughs in Wrigleyville. So there's a lot going on. We got things covered tonight. Stick with 720 WGN as we give you the reaction and analysis from tonight's Game 7 of the World Series, in which the Cubs are in. It's amazing. I guess the best way to look at it right now is there are three innings left of baseball in 2016. Right, this is the end of essentially an amazing season, 2016 of baseball here in Chicago, from the summer, from the way both teams started, the Cubs and the Sox, to the way the Cubs finished with 103 games, to the San Francisco NLDS, to the LA Dodgers NLCS, and then to the 7-game World Series against the Cleveland Indians. Game 7, of course, in Cleveland right now, 7th inning. We will take a break and we will get to updates with Rob Martyr. Stay with us.
Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is the city's Youth Poet Laureate. Iman Loren spent her high school years performing in Louder Than a Bomb, the citywide poetry slam tournament that we've talked about a few times in this program. She was crowned champion in 2014-2015, and this year has been a great one for the West and South Side product, who was just included in the new Bohemia Rising Star issue in Chicago Magazine. Not bad for the 19-year-old Iman Loren. Welcome to The Download.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let me ask you, I mean, this is the first time that the city's had a Youth Poet Laureate. What's it mean to you to be the Youth Poet Laureate of the whole city?
Yeah, it's very surreal. It's kind of scary a little bit. I don't really like to think, oh, you a legend and, like, you're a history maker. It's just an honor to the fact that I'm, like, a start to making a pavement for others to pay homage to. As I pay homage to Gwendolyn Brooks, Rita Dove, you know, the first African-American women who were poet laureates, who were winner of, you know, peace prizes, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very surreal, and it's kind of, you know, I don't like the word normal, but just like, you know, I still get negatives on my venture cards. And, you know, Uber drivers are still rude to me.
No, I don't want to hear that. They should give you a free pass in the CTA.
That's what,
right?
I'm saying. Like,
I would just assume any poet laureate would get that.
I guess not.
Okay. Well, let's talk about how you got into poetry, because we'll talk a little bit about the book and everything that's coming out. But as a 19-year-old, talk about how you first were introduced to poetry in your life.
So I was first widely introduced to, like, just the whole, like, culture of just storytelling. My parents, both of them, predominantly raised me in culture. A lot of Spike Lee movies, a lot of Anansi tales, you know. And when I was in elementary school, young elementary school, I started writing in third and fourth grade, and they would always host these competitions every year, these poetry book competitions, or just like a regular book competition. And I was like, I'm gonna just write a poetry book, and I would win every year. And it was just like okay, this must be my thing. You know what I'm saying? And so then it started with speech competitions, Maya Angelou poems, et cetera, et cetera.
When did you start getting serious about it? I mean, obviously having great opportunities as a kid in third, fourth grade to write books, to write poetry books. But when did you realize that this is something more than just something you do each year for a school project?
I think when it really became like a very big shift in my family, especially like as I started getting older and like a lot of personal issues from my family that was, you know, my biological family that was really like taking a heavy toll on me. And it was often derived that there was a specific route and path in which we had to like follow, do good in school so that you can go to college, so that you can get a job. And it was like, I don't want that because I've seen, you know, I've seen my mom work herself through like so many banks throughout all Chicago. And I seen my father like be a construction worker. It was just, I just knew that that was not, I was not, I was just very much determined not to follow a path that was predestined or pre-picked to be, you know, qualified as successful.
You know, your poetry, I mean, a lot of the stuff focuses on personal issues. I mean, and you, whether it be breakups or sexuality or abuse in your past. I mean, talk about that. Talk about how you use poetry to help you to get over some of those issues. Not just necessarily get over, maybe that's not the right way to say it, but just to deal with those issues in your life.
I think something with poetry, something that like I was taught in school with poetry, with like, you know, the grade A, this is what poetry is, William Shakespeare's, it has to rhyme. And, you know, there's this great fluff around, you know, this beautiful language and imagery. And I'm like, cool, great, that's awesome. But my homies on the block is not finna understand what this mean. You know what I'm saying? Like, if I was to read this to my niece while I'm doing her hair, she would not understand what I'm saying. She'll think I'm probably speaking in another language. So what I wanted to do is that I like to really evolve my storytelling and the way that I actually talk to people, the way that we actually communicate, because that is what actual storytelling is. You know, our ebonics, our colloquialisms, you know, how we communicate, you know, what our, you know, etymology of our languages and what all of that is derived from and like how that translates into what we actually do every day and like the purpose of that. So that's all I really like ultimately try to do. Just like keep it like, when you read it, you can like really hear my voice.
Well, there's,
with it.
I mean, there's actually in the written page, but you're also a performance poet in the way that you perform it. And you, in the performances that I've seen, the emotion is what propels the poem. You know, like you said, the rhyming and the words are tremendous, but there's something about the emotion that you bring to it. Talk about where that comes from.
So I remember, so I slammed with Kumba Lynx during LTAP. I also slammed with Kiri my first 2 years, but I slammed with Kumba Lynx my next 2 years.
And what is, for everyone listening, Kumba Lynx?
Kumba Lynx Performance Ensemble there in Uptown. Great, great coaches, Jacinda and Jaquanda, great, great coaches and mentors. And they really actually helped me a lot as far as like performance and like, you know, getting my breath, take a break. Actually helping me see that performance is an actual craft. It's more to it than just stepping up to a mic and breathing your words out. It's more so really like wholeheartedly putting your body into your words. And so when I perform, I really cannot explain where that energy comes from. And it's not more so much as like I try to like flash back to where I was in that point in time. It's just reflecting on where I am now and like how I got there. And so, like, with that struggle of from where I was when I was going through that and, like, being able to actually tell that to now, I try to, like, swoop myself through that escalade of emotion of there to now.
We're talking with Chicago's Youth Poet Laureate, Iman Loren. She is a South and West Side product. I'm interested. I mean, you've done Louder Than a Bomb, young Chicago authors. We've had on this program a lot of artists who have identified or said, that is, I did Young Chicago Authors, I was a poet in the back, and that's what launched me, or, you know, I've been doing poetry slams in Chicago. Talk about that community, what you know about the history of Young Chicago Authors, and the amount of talent that has come through this city, through those doors and others.
All right, so I started going, well, Young Chicago Authors has held me since I was maybe 13, 14 years old. I was really, really young in Young Chicago Authors, literally like eighth grade, right going into high school. And so when I remember seeing the space, I remember when the space was actually different, like the stage was set up different, the people who would be there, just seeing like total transition, right? And this was also like during the time that like Chance was at U Media and like, you know, Vic and pretty much predominant Save Money Collective crews mm-hmm. were like, you know, around
the hip-hop
in the
artists
scene.
Of this generation, yes. This time that are all blowing up right now. Yeah.
Yes. So I remember going to YCA and just being like, okay, this is cool, right? Like, I wasn't, like, sold, like, all right, this is, like, something that could, like, launch a career, because I wasn't thinking about that.
Right, you're an eighth grader, right.
Right, and at that time, like, school is telling us, oh, if you want to be an artist, you need a backup plan. You need a plan B, right? So you got to, you know, just get your job on and then just pick a selective hobby, right? But I knew it wasn't a hobby. I don't feel anything that you, like, really like. I mean, sure, you can absolutely drive and, you know, motivate yourself for your hobbies. That's wonderful. But as far as, like, making it your passion and making it your craft, I feel like that goes way beyond deeper than just a hobby.
Yeah.
It comes what you live for. You know what I'm saying? Like, I quit jobs just to be like, I miss teaching. Like, I miss writing. Like,
well, there's a lot of sacrifice that goes into being an artist. I mean, and even if someone at a young age as yours, 19, I mean, you do have to make choices in what you want to do. That you, this could be a hobby. It could be a plan B.
Mm-hmm.
But in your case, you're going for it. You're going all in as a poet and as an artist. Talk about that. I mean, is that a scary venture to be this? I mean, obviously being young, that helps you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you're making a midlife change.
Right.
But talk about that. Talk about the idea of really putting all your chips in and saying, this is who I'm going to be.
And to be honest, I haven't really thought about that fear, like, since you just asked me
No.
But,
sorry, I apologize.
No, it's perfectly fine.
I'm projecting myself on
no,
you.
No, like, and that makes me, like, so happy because I really know in my heart of hearts I'm going to be good. Because the one thing that I used to be really scared of, and, like, especially seeing, like, what my mom especially went through in corporate America is, you know, crashing of markets, right? Like, I remember when I was real young, Mos Def was in this movie, Something the Lord Made, where he was, you know, the John Hopkins, mm-hmm. the first African-American to perform open heart surgery. And all his money was in the bank. The bank crashed and he was broke. I'm like, wow, so that could happen.
That's something I didn't know could happen. Right.
We're corporate America. But I'm like, I'm an artist. I have so many stories that I have not told yet and so many stories that have not happened yet. And I'm like, that's a whole lifetime mm-hmm. of currency. You know, that's a whole lifetime of possibility. And it's the work. In the community, what we call the work is the actual craft and the actual dedication of molding the story and all the branches of whatever you come from. I come from the five branches of hip hop, but like molding all of those branches together to like tell your story. As long as I like stay true to myself, something mm-hmm. my mom always says, if you cannot be true to yourself, who can you be true to? And if I stay true to myself and keep my stories going, constantly read, constantly write, constantly look for motivation for myself and like figure out who I am and like what I plan to venture to do, I feel like I will always be good.
As the youth poet laureate, I mean, you in some ways become an ambassador for the youth
mm-hmm.
and for the stories that are coming out. And Louder Than the Bomb has done this very well, where you get to tell your stories your way. You're not told by the media and other people. Do you feel like the young generations in Chicago, whether it be communities of color or otherwise, just kids that are 19, 20, are their stories being heard? Are we telling them the right way? I mean, what do you say to people who might be listening in WGN Radio or 50, 55 years old
mm-hmm.
who are listening right now saying, yeah, I want to know more about your story?
In like, you know, the protest scene or, you know, the current fight that is going on as far as Black Lives Matter, as far as like the movement that is going on, something that I often and always have a problem with are the reporters that are there. The white dudes with the big cameras that block all of the kids, you know, that are trying to gather around the open mics that we're doing. And I say it, I be like, bro, can you please get out the way? Like, this is not your story. And if it was a story that you are trying to tell, why don't you give the kids the camera? Why don't you give them, like, the lens? You want the story? That's the story. But you blocking them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when we all see people like Chance, right, and his great, magnificent coloring day, everybody says, like, I don't know him face to face, but I'm so proud of him. I'm, like, so amazed. Like, he did it. He's doing it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, like, what I'm supposed to do. Like, I'm doing it. When I see a lot of people who come to me, like, especially in the LTAP community, they were like, how did you do it? I remember, like, you was just sitting next to us. You know what I'm saying? Like, now you're hosting the open mic. How did you, like, stay here? Like, you have to stay. If you are determined, if you, first off, if you know this is what you want to do and this is where you want to be, don't see it as a cliche. Don't see it as, you know, some type of, you should always see it as some type of outlet. But it should never be, if this is, like, your, like, derived dream, then make it that. Don't make it a plan B. Make it your plan A. And I think that when I talk to a lot of youth, they like look at me like a magic trick or a magic show. And a lot of times, like, of course, like they feel like favoritism could come into that. But that's never the case at all, because there are no favorites in the world of art. I feel like everybody knows that. Like, we've seen so many hip hop stories where it's like favoritism is never like a really key. And if it is, then it never really works out like that. So I just really try to, like, stay true to the story that you're telling and who you are and, like, the mission that you want to have for yourself.
Do you feel like the youth of Chicago, they have a voice?
Yes. I feel like the youth of Chicago voice is more prominent than I've ever seen, more than ever. I just, like, remember, like, reflecting back to high school, how, like, silenced I was in just the building of high school. And when I would get outside of high school, it was still hard. It was still hard to speak, because we always have adults speaking for us. Chicago, not just Chicago, like the world is living in such an adultist state right now, where they feel like youth do not have power. Mm-hmm. And it's not even like the power of who is over who, or like a power of like anarchy. It's just a matter of power of like making choices.
Yeah, or telling your own story.
Yes.
Someone else got to tell it for you, right?
Yes, exactly.
I'll take care of this.
Yeah. It's like you don't know that much about your ancestry. I got a little bit more years on you, let me tell you, right? And so one of the reasons why I'm really appreciative for like folks that has raised me is because they allow me to take what I know, and they give me information based off of what I do know. It's never like a, okay, you know this, let me make it better. It's more so on a, you know this, let's see how we can add to it.
Okay, so the book coming out, tell us about it. I mean, is this going to be a collection of poetry? What is Commando? What do we need to know about it?
So Commando is my first chapter book. I'm looking to release it sometime around like next year, beginning of next year. And it actually is a spinoff from my first playwright that I performed at the Chicago Hip Hop Theater Festival, which is basically an exploration of different types of domestic relationships that embodies like spoken word, music, poetry. And so what I wanted to do with Commando in a chapter book, I really wanted to make it, what does it mean to really be open? What does it really mean to be ready for action? And how can we like all be Commando in a sense?
Well, when it comes out, you got to come back on.
Yes.
How about that?
Yes.
Iman Loren is the city's youth poet laureate. Chicago in all her life. She's 19 years old. The book Commando coming out earlier next year. Iman Loren, thanks so much for coming in. It's great to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Woohoo! It's Chicago. It is November, and it is the World Series. The Chicago Cubs lead 6-3 in the top of the eighth inning. Wow. Aroldis Chapman is warming up in the bullpen. This is, of course, when the strategy starts. The closer for the Cleveland Indians is already in the game. Aroldis Chapman warming up. Do you stay with John Lester, potential Cy Young winner? Do you go to your red-hot Rolaids closer, Aroldis Chapman? Chapstick? Oh, man. I just had to, in the break, do a pep talk to my son, who is being let, he could stay up late. It's a great little story. Some of my favorite memories, and the one that I remember is from 1984, where I tried my best to try and stay up for the late San Diego Padres games. And I remember waking up, and this is sort of a story in the family, that I went, "Hey, Grandpa, did the Cubs win?" He's like, "No, they lost. Let's go." It was the game that Steve Garvey hit the home run. And I was like, what happened? It was like that. I tried to stay up, and it just didn't happen. Like, I fell asleep. And my son is in the same position right now. He's a late bloomer to the Cubs. But he has finally, in the last 2 days, he's absorbed it.
All right.
Yeah, he gets up. He asks about it. He gets excited. He goes, "Yes, if the Cubs win." If they lose, he's like, "Oh." So he's excited, and today, I think it's probably more he's just excited to stay up.
be honest with you. But he is, from all reports, fading.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and I'm like, and I said, that's perfect. Perfect. He's going to have the same memory that I had. Did they win? And except it may be a yes.
Well, let's hope.
So very excited. You know, he's only got, what, an inning and a half to get through, because obviously Cleveland's going to bat it in the bottom of the ninth. So, yeah, we'll see if he stays up. I hope he can do it. Maybe during Martyr's newscast I'll have to
get him some coffee.
Yeah, I'll have to give him a pep talk, a Jay Cutler pep talk, right? That's so exciting. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour, of course, we'll have post-game from tonight's Game 7 World Series. It's still, it's hard to believe. Chicago Cubs, Cleveland Indians World Series Game 7, playoff, the True Blue Playoff Plus, which will be with Andy Mazur, Adam Hogue, Carms in Cleveland, Kev's in Cleveland, Ryan Burroughs in Wrigleyville, Kristen Decker's in Wrigleyville. I mean, we are ready. The WGN team has been dispersed, and we are ready to cover this amazing, amazing story tonight as the game gets ready to wrap up. But before we do that, let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll get the updates from Rob Martyr. Stay with us. Bottom of the eighth inning, the Indians and wow. Cubs in Cleveland getting exciting. John Lester still on the mound. Got to like that, Rob, right?
You know what? I had faith in it the whole way through, man. I knew exactly what Joe Maddon was
last
doing.
Night when he went to Chapman in the seventh inning, you yeah. said, that's because he's going to take Lester all the way through.
Hey, Phil Jackson was the Zen master. Joe Maddon is the Zen. He's Zen. I mean, these guys are Zen.
They're Zen.
They're unflappable.
They're unflappable. You know, it's really enjoyable is that my wife is watching the game with my son, and she never watches baseball.
Yeah.
The hilarious texts I've got about what's happening and who these players are. She said some choice things about Kyle Schwarber. She's like, what's this guy? What's that? And then she just said, why can't this guy throw the ball to first? That's what I said, no, that's a thing. It's psychological. Like trying to explain that to her. Well, he's got a psychological problem where he can't throw the ball.
Me and her should hang out and watch games.
If you were watching the game and you heard the announcers going, having a hard time throwing the ball to first base, you'd be like, little leaguers throw it to first base, right?
Well, if you want to get a gauge on the range of emotions, Mrs. Rob is a diehard Cubs fan.
Yeah, how's
so
that?
When things start going badly for the Cubs, it's the F and all the F's are coming out. And then when things are going well, God, I love these guys. Look at that. Yeah. That was fantastic. Look at Dexter Fowler. He's so awesome.
Exactly.
Yeah. There you go.
She says she's stress. She has, even though this is her first day being a Cubs fan, she has stress eaten all the Halloween candy. I'm like, I don't think it has anything to do with the Cubs. I'm going to be honest with you at this point. All this history calls to me. My God, it's been so long. We need a new attitude. Something to right the wrongs. Ever since the curse, we thought it couldn't get worse. But still, the Cubbies rock. The Cubbies rock. Harry, Jack, and Steve help us all to believe. Saying Cubbies rock. Cubbies rock. Cubbies rock, that's right, 720 WGN, I'm Justin Kaufman. Wow, a big double for Guyer off the bench.
Yeah, Brandon Guyer.
Yeah, it's a dumb name.
Well, you know the old saying in baseball, Justin?
What's
Bob,
that?
It all happens with two outs. That's right, yeah. Steve, here in the bottom of the eighth inning.
Well, we were kind of joking about it early in the show, yeah. Like the pundits, the sport pundits are going to have a field day if Aroldis Chapman runs into any trouble. They're going to be like, see, this is why you don't pitch him, blah, blah, blah.
But I've always been tough on pitchers. I know they're creatures of habit. Right. I know they like their routine. But when you're at this level, you're in this situation, you get out there.
Yeah.
You know?
And frankly, you know, you get to a certain point where the Indians hitters have seen Aroldis Chapman now, what? Four or five times in this series.
Yeah, at least.
You know, and so they are understanding him a little bit more. He throws fast. That's his thing. And so they're probably, the players have some tape on him. They're starting to work a little bit more, some personal experience. So it's going to be a little bit tougher this time through to get each guy out. Obviously, he inherited a runner from John Lester who scored off the double from Brandon Guyer. He's on second base right now as he continues to pitch Aroldis Chapman. Against the top of the Indians order, which if he gets out of this, there's two outs. That means that the ninth inning will be the heart of the Cleveland Indians lineup. the 2-3-4 to face Aroldis Chapman for a World Series victory. Oh, man. Wow, you couldn't write it up anymore. Like,
no.
Yeah, that's going to be it. In a two-run game right now, the Cubs have a two-run lead. You really, really want to get Rajah Davis here because you don't want this to be a one-run game where one swing of the bat can tie it up. You really want to get out of this inning now.
I'm sweating. I mean, I'm sweating profusely. And I'm just sitting here.
That was a long newscast, though. You know, maybe you did do some work.
Well, it all comes from the diaphragm, Justin.
That's right.
Got to get that big voice out there.
It's not that just, you know, I wouldn't say it's stress sweat. You've worked. You were just working hard.
It's stress because I'm 30 pounds overweight. That's why.
No, absolutely not. You were working hard. You had to work in scores. There was an actual update to the game inside the cast. This is not child's play, Rob Martire. You're in game seven territory.
Man, when you reach WGN, this is the big leagues right here, baby.
This is the big leagues and a big time night here, 720 WGN. So Aroldis Chapman on the mound. They still are playing out this inning.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Uh-oh, that one's gone. That one is gone. It's a two-run homer. Justin, pick it up.
He nailed it. Rajah Davis hits a two-run home run off of Aroldis Chapman to tie the game in the bottom of the eighth inning. Aroldis Chapman, of course, coming in early to try and get a what would essentially be a four-out save after questions about whether Aroldis Chapman should have been in the game as long as he was last night with a five-run lead. Joe Maddon brought him in to pitch in the seventh inning last night. Aroldis Chapman brought in when John Lester gave up a single with two outs. And Aroldis Chapman just gave up a two-run homer to Rajah Davis, who I don't know his regular season stats, but he's not a home run hitter. He's a stolen base guy. So for Rajah Davis to hit a home run, this is very Scotty Pasednik-like.
You hit the nail on the head, though, Justin, when you said they've now seen him a few times. So they know what to look for. Yeah. They know what to go after. And if you ever watch the documentary Fastball, as quickly as a 100-mile-plus-per-hour pitcher comes in at you, the ball goes just as fast out.
Well, this is tough for Joe Maddon, too, because you now have a closer who has essentially given up three runs in the eighth inning. Obviously, you just need to get out of it here because then you can see what you have to do in the ninth. But Aroldis Chapman is used here. Another hit, a single for the Cleveland Indians. So they do have the go-ahead runner on first base. But Aroldis Chapman is used. At a certain point, you're going to have to make a decision whether or not he's, as Joe Maddon looks to his card, but what do you do in this case with the fact that John Lester's out? Jake Arrieta?
Well, and Pete's a much more astute observer of the Cubs than you and I are, being Southside fans. But when you are a one-trick pony, basically, that Chapman is, and you throw 100 miles per hour, and that's all you have in your arsenal, what more do you go to? I mean, maybe Pete can help me out here. I don't know. You know, when you don't have a whole lot of pitches in your repertoire, it's tough.
That's it. He throws fast.
He's pretty good at locating, too. I mean, he throws fast and he throws strikes. He's not a kind of guy that's going to lose control here. But I guess that's the issue. I mean, if you're going to throw strikes and they know it, they're swinging. So they're not missing, let's put it that way, tonight. And, kudos to the Cleveland Indians that they're back against the wall. They know that the closer's coming in, and their batting order is taking advantage of that. In this case, now you have now you're in a situation where here comes the heart of the Cleveland Indians roster. This is going to be their three hitter, I believe, is coming up here. Shots of LeBron James, who's sitting in the bleachers, who is freaking out. All right, collective deep breath. We'll take a break here so we can stay on target. Of course, we're bringing you postgame here on 720 WGN. We'll do True Blue Playoff Plus when the game is over. We're in the bottom of the eighth inning with a tie game. The Chicago Cubs and Cleveland Indians. We'll be back with more. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Coming up, we are going to have True Blue Playoff Plus, sponsored by Wintrust, home of Cubs Checking, Sloan, Water Connects Us, Andy Mazur, and Adam Hoge are going to join us, Mark Carmen, Kevin Powell in Cleveland, Progressive Field, and a slew of WGN reporters are in and about Chicago, including Wrigleyville. Ryan Burrows at Murphy's. We'll talk with him as well. Right now, if you're following the game, probably not listening to us, but if you are, the Chicago Cubs and the Cleveland Indians tied going into the top of the ninth as a amazing, amazing turn of events. Not good for the Cubs, where Aroldis Chapman gave up three runs, two earned, on a two-run shot by Rashad Davis to tie the game. The Cubs were leading 6-3 in the eighth inning. For you as a longtime Cubs fan, Pete, does this unnerve you?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really irritated with Joe Maddon.
Are you?
I'm one of these guys. I'm not
so
tweeting
really,
about
so you're
it,
really angry about the way the coach has handled the pitching staff here in the final games of the World Series.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, you know, I am. I'm mad that Hendricks came out. You know, that worked out.
Right.
Obviously, with Ross and Lester coming in, Lester did fine. But bringing Chapman in the eighth, I never liked that.
Yeah, you've
seemed to work out for most of the times he's done it. But
well, what's interesting right now is the resolve of Cubs Nation. You know, the Chicago Cubs are not losing. They're tied. And
yep.
This is sort of what happened, if you remember, a couple of years back. We won't name the year, but when the Cubs had a loss, a tough loss at the end of the year, they almost, even though they still had a game to play, they were really down and out about that opportunity. I don't think this game is over. You've seen the Chicago Cubs lineup play well and play with some determination and some young stars of potential MVPs in Bryant and Rizzo. They're playing in an AL park. Means a pitcher doesn't have to bat here. A lot of options. Kyle Schwarber should be up, I believe. If not this inning, like I think he might be Fowler. I think he's gonna be a third guy up this inning. So there's a lot to go here. So my point being that there's still optimism.
Yeah, and
in
I think
Chicago Cub land.
I think you're absolutely right. Even you know I'm mad, but in years past I would be like devastated. I'm like, oh, this is it. They blew it. It's over. They had their chance. They lost it. And now I'm confident. I was confident when they went down 3-1. I'm like, all right, we got Lester, Arrieta, Hendricks. You know, we can do this.
Well, it changes. I mean, it is interesting, the temperament of when a team shows a little resolve and almost in the face of its culture. With the Chicago Cubs, you have a tremendous culture of futility around it, and sometimes that weight will crush. But let's see how this team responds, you know, as they head into the ninth inning.
Let me jump in here real quick, Justin and Pete. Word now off of the broadcast that it's beginning to rain at Progressive Field.
Yeah, they just showed a shot of the field from the lights, and you could see the rain coming down.
Yeah, it's coming down hard. It's the same rain that came through here earlier today, correct? I mean, wouldn't that be the same? I mean, Cleveland's not far enough.
Yeah, I don't know.
It does. Yeah, it is the idea. That's what Skilling was saying earlier, that the same weather pattern systems go through. They just come in a couple hours later. And this was, if you looked out at 4:30, 5 o'clock today in Chicago, this is what was on the ground. And that was a big storm. So hopefully they can end this game.
Oh, man.
I think of the rain, Super Bowl 10 years ago when it was raining like cats and dogs in Miami when the Bears were trying to come back on the Colts.
And that game started off fantastically with a Devin Hester return, as this game did with a Dexter Fowler home run. So the results are different.
Well, good news. The David Ross, the pit boss, as we call him here on the download, draws a leadoff walk.
All right.
Taken out of the game, of course. So Miguel Montero, the only catcher available now, will finish it out for the Cubs from here on out. But David Ross does his job. He draws a walk, and the Cubs have a runner on first base as they attempt to take the lead back here in the ninth inning. So, yeah, you're right. The weather's not going to help. And what do you do in a situation like this? Do they do a rain delay?
Yeah.
If they feel like it gets too much and too muddy, or they just try to push through because it's going to take a little bit. I mean, the Indians, you know, the catcher's coming out to the mound, things of that nature. But, I mean, this reminds me of a very sensitive time in my life pitching for Little League when it was raining and there was mud and they didn't want to call it, and I was pitching and I couldn't get the traction and the ball was muddy, and it was just one of those, the parents were like, we need to finish this game, you know, before, we're not going to call it, because you didn't put a tarp down in Little League.
It was
like, you're like, And I just remember, like, the mud all over the socks and the jersey and trying to throw the ball. And it didn't. It's not a good memory.
You think you had it bad? Try keeping score when the rain's coming down.
Oh, yeah.
I had brilliant score sheets when I was in Little League. Then all of a sudden it starts to run and you lose track of who's up and who's good. I mean, come on, man. You know, here I am, a pudgy little kid on the bench trying to keep accurate score.
I guess I never thought of the scorekeepers.
Come on, man. Well, you know.
Well, that's good. You were the scorekeeper guy, huh?
Or I played right field.
Yeah, but you also, did you score when you were out and right? You really kept it with you? Had it on your pocket?
I was in the part of the field that they never cut, the grass. You know, that's where the fence ended.
Right, right.
You know, so that if someone actually did hit it out in that area, right. I'd be chasing it for like 5 minutes.
That one, that's like a law, that's a Little League law, that there has to be an open fence area.
Right.
That goes and rolls into the cemetery or whatever is behind the Little League diamond.
That's there hilarious. I am trying to pull out my pants as I'm chasing down a fly ball that went 500 feet. You know, and then all along the way, we've got about a half dozen cutoff men because you can only throw so far in Little League.
Right. There's nine guys lined up.
Bink, 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 bink.
They're all yelling.
Tragic.
Robbie, come on, throw the ball, Robbie.
It really was.
Come on, Bobby.
Years of therapy. You're kidding me?
Oh, man.
Years of therapy.
Oh, my Lord. All right, so we'll take a quick break here, and we'll come back, and we'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll get Rob to give us an update on the game as well. As we know, it's still nobody out. Cubs got a runner on first in the ninth inning. Tied up in Cleveland, Game 7. That's my heart. That's everybody's heart. That's Chicago's heart. Stay with us. The rain coming down in Cleveland, where the Chicago Cubs and the Cleveland Indians playing in the ninth inning of the Game 7 World Series. I'm Justin Kaufman here on 720 WGN. Woo! What a roller coaster. The Cubs, if you have not been watching, which I'm sure you have, this may be for our Missouri listeners, people who listen in all the different states that WGN carries to an AM radio.
People that are driving around that can't get other stations.
Maybe
in.
They have a real, like you work nights and you have a real strict no media policy. Your boss is like, hey, don't check that phone. Hey, don't check that radio. Hey, did you look at that TV? The Cubs had a 6-3 lead in the eighth inning. They brought in Aroldis Chapman to start what would be a four-out save. John Lester was in before, and he had two outs. And Aroldis Chapman, unfortunately, gave up a double, which brought in a run. And then Rajah Davis, journeyman, played in all sorts of towns, picked up for the Indians, I believe, right around he was on the Tigers at one point this season, I believe. He's picked up around the trading deadline. He comes in and hits a two-run homer to tie the game 6-6, and that was in the eighth inning. And right now, the Chicago Cubs are batting in the top of the ninth, one out, runner on first. Jason Hayward's on first. Javi Baez at the plate, who has already hit a solo home run tonight, also committed two errors early in the game, but he hit a solo home run as well. So the Cubs and the Indians in Game 7 of the World Series in the top of the ninth, tied. Oh, boy. It's hard. It's hard. It's hard to watch. I mean, there really is definitely, I mean, people who are watching right now, they're screamed out. They're probably hoarse. There's definitely a very stressful emotion surrounding this.
They showed the Murphys. You know, they have a camera at Murphys,
yeah, right,
you know,
right.
And they showed the shot of
the Cubs fans.
The Cubs fans after the home run was hit.
It was bad.
It was bad. I mean, I'm laughing here. I'm a huge Cubs fan, but it was like, oh, man, it looked pathetic. It looked really sad.
Oh, no. I just saw on Twitter. I mean, I looked at Twitter for a second, and then I decided better to shut it down.
Yeah, a lot of people writing in caps.
Yeah, a lot of caps late in the game. But Mindy Kaling had one saying, please stop showing all the elderly Cubs fans in the stands. It's too much to bear.
The thing is, they show with Cubs fans, they show people that are 90 to 100. With Indians fans, they show them about 60 or 70.
Okay, yeah. But that's about right. I mean, if you're going to think about it, you know, the losing streaks and whatnot with these two teams.
Speaking of fans, I was irritated over the weekend by one Mr. John Hamm.
Yeah, I don't understand that. Why is he wearing a St. Louis Cardinals hat?
Why is he there?
Is he just an antagonist?
Yeah.
Is he just got tickets because he's rich and he has no connection to Chicago, right?
I mean, he knows he's a baseball fan, but
maybe he likes the he just wants to mess with the mess with the fans.
But showing up in Wrigley Field on those important games and wearing a Cardinals hat is
that's not good.
I was really upset with him, and I don't think he was there on Sunday, the game they won. So if we want to look for a villain,
it's Mad Men.
It's John Hamm.
It's John Hamm. So good news, not necessarily game-changing yet, but Jason Hayward steals second base. The ball scatters into center field. Jason Hayward takes third. So Jason Hayward and the Chicago Cubs are on third base with one out.
All right.
One out.
Fly ball. Let's get a fly ball.
And a 3-2 count on Javi Baez.
Or a pass ball.
So a switch quickly as the Cleveland Indians make a defensive adjustment. Not a pitching change, but a defensive adjustment. They take Coco Crisp out of the game, and they bring in a player off the bench to play left field. Must have a better arm as we get ready for. Well, it's interesting. I mean, wouldn't you say as a Cubs fan, I mean, you've been very disappointed with the play of Jason Hayward.
Yeah, I have.
He hit 230, had 7 home runs. Not at all what we thought we were getting when we talked about a all-star from the St. Louis Cardinals who had 22 home runs and hit 285, something of that nature. But we've always talked about his defense and his ability to steal bases.
Yeah.
Or at least be a good base runner.
Good base runner, yep.
And he shows it here with a stealing second and being able to wisely heads up, take off, even though that ball just kind of squirted away, and make it to third here in the bottom of the ninth of Game 7 of the World Series. And, yeah, so.
He's had some really nice plays. He threw a runner at home. He had a great catch down the right field line. So, yeah, he's been good, yeah.
Javi Baez looked to be the hero in a very unorthodox way. He bunted to try and do a safety squeeze here to bring Jason Hayward home. But the youngster bunted foul with 2 strikes, missed his opportunity, and struck out. Not a good showing for Javi Baez, who, and Joe Maddon making the call, a very controversial call here to have Javi Baez try to bunt to bring Jason Hayward home from third. That would have been very theatrical, very dramatic if that play would have gone the Cubs' way. Instead, Baez fouls the bunt with 2 strikes, which is an out.
It'll be interesting to see in the post-game press conference when he's asked about it if that was a Javi Baez thing doing that on his own
or if that was a call. Because with 2 strikes, usually you're not going to get that sign. I mean, it's, like I said, very unorthodox. But I also probably catching the Indians sleeping a little bit.
What I enjoy about the post-game press conferences is that I don't know if you play this game, but I do. When I'm watching the post-game press conference, I listen for the question. I go, Phil Rogers, MLB.
Did you hear today one of the guys asked Terry Francona to end the press conference? He said, so Terry, is this a must-win game? It was a joke, but it was funny like the way it did. Oh, boy. And Terry Francona, wow. So the Chicago Cubs do not get out of the inning. A ground ball to short. Dexter Fowler hit it up the middle, but there was a shift on for Dexter Fowler. Francisco Lindor, one of the tremendous young talents here in Major League Baseball, shows some range on the other side of second base to get the ball and throw out Dexter Fowler by a nose.
Yeah.
Good wow, play. That is a play. The shortstop is where the second baseman is at.
Beat him by a lot, actually. Throw beat him by a
That's amazing.
And a half.
That's an amazing play by Francisco Lindor to keep the Indians in this game, to keep the Cubs from getting a run. We go to the bottom of the ninth now with the Cleveland Indians and tied with the Cubs. Not how we thought this was going to play out, especially just one inning ago. Pretty crazy. Got nothing to say.
I don't
know. Oh boy.
Guess I'm not. Now I'm thinking about. Let's see. On my way home, will Belmont, Addison, and Sheffield still be closed? Because I can zip right by that on the red. It'll be like an express train.
You're excited, right? But Pete's excited because he's like, oh, I can zip right
past
there.
Yeah, can zip by that. Yeah.
That's a good 15-20 minutes I saved right there. No stops. All right. Yikes, man. I don't know what to say about it. I mean, you know, this is sort of unexpected in the way that the Cubs had been in control of this game for the entire Game 7 of the World Series, except for two batters. a double and a home run for the Cleveland Indians, was able to produce three runs. Those runs tied a game in which the Cubs had the lead 6-3. And now we're going into the bottom of the ninth with a tie game. John Smoltz was sort of quoted all day today saying, he said last night in the broadcast, he said he sees this going into extra innings. The Cubs have to do their job here in the bottom of the ninth to keep Cleveland off the board. But right now, if the Cubs can do that, this is a extra innings World Series Game 7 match.
Oof.
All right, let's take a break, and then we'll come back and give you an update where we're at in this one. Quick update on my personal life. The boy is asleep. He couldn't handle it. I don't know what to say about that. But.
So very well, maybe exactly like your...
Yeah.
Your experience. Did the Cubs win?
and maybe if this thing keeps going,
I'm
yeah.
sure they won, right?
Right. No, go to bed. Like my grandpa. No. No, they lost. All right. Thanks, Grandpa. Thanks for not spreading. Thanks for no drama on that one, Grandpa. It's interesting. My grandpa, I thought about this. He died in 1996. So it's been about 20 years now. But, you know, it's all these stories about the Cubs and generations and things. And the one thing that I knew about him is he played in the citywide, you know, sort of public league championships. And I forgot. I don't remember. I'd have to ask my dad about what was the organization. But there was a point where Little League would go play.
Yeah.
In
Wrigley
around,
Field?
Yeah, around. And at the end, they would play at Wrigley Field, like the championship,
yeah.
And he won. And he had on his wall, like, the team pitcher, you know, and he was a catcher. And I always, like, I told my son that this, you know, I said, your great-grandpa played at Wrigley Field. He was on the Cubs? Well, no, but he caught on the Little League team that got to go to Wrigley Field, so... Anyway, the Chicago Cubs and the Cleveland Indians, if you're just joining us, if you're just joining this planet, are, if you're an alien that just touched down, you're like, what should I do? Where should I go? The Chicago Cubs and the Cleveland Indians are in the bottom of the ninth inning, tied. Bottom of the ninth inning of just a regular game and a regular July. No. No, this is game seven. Game seven of the NLDS? No. It is Game 7 of the World Series. The Chicago Cubs and Cleveland Indians, in dramatic fashion, tied 6-6 in the bottom of the ninth. One out, a 3-2 count on Jason Kipnis from Chicago.
Yeah, did you know that he was from Northbrook?
I did. How many times have we been told that, right? It's kind of annoying at this point.
I have to say that I am not a Joe Buck hater.
Really?
Yeah. And I get a lot of grief about it at home that I'm not. And I actually like John Smoltz.
Smoltz has done a good job, his analysis
as well.
I'm not a huge fan of Joe Buck because I feel as if Joe Buck has a allegiance issue because he's with the Cardinals. You know, if you go to St. Louis, there's Joe Buck restaurants everywhere. And I feel like some of the really sensational players on the Dodgers or the Indians have gotten so much more adoration than the Cubs players.
You felt that, yeah.
I did. Corey Kluber, I mean, it was a little over the top. I mean, everyone kind of made the memes about Clayton Kershaw. But it just is like he's really into the players. And last night I thought he was way too dramatic about Aroldis Chapman. And he had a line in the broadcast. It was like, 62 pitches over two games were they – day off in the middle. And I was like, that doesn't mean anything. At the end of the day, you're like, that's a stat that is so fake. Like, I'm like, you can't do that. You can't take a number of pitches you've pitched in the last two games. That's like saying Lester with 226 pitches in the last, and that doesn't mean anything.
Well,
there you go.
There's Justin, it's not just the pitching, Justin. It's the up and down of the bullpen. He has to get up in the bullpen, and then he has to sit down in the bullpen. Then he's got to get up again. You know, that taxes
that
you.
That taxes you out. Aroldis Chapman strikes out Jason Kipnis. Two outs here for the Cleveland Indians. Here comes
and he's from Glenbrook North, by the way.
There you go, see? You got to throw that in every time.
It's a nice manicured beard.
There's a trademark next to his name. Jason Kipnis, Glenbrook North. Glenbrook North. Francisco Lindor has not done well at the plate tonight. He's 0 for 4. He has had a pretty great World Series. He does not seem to be intimidated for a young shortstop.
Great player.
But that play he made in the top of the ninth inning to keep Dexter Fowler off base, or, I mean, to would have scored Jason Hayward. He, as the shortstop, ran across second base to field that and make that play at ease. You don't see too many shortstops making that kind of jump on the ball and break on the ball and being able to throw them out like that in a pressure situation at the top of the ninth inning in a World Series Game 7. Francisco Lindor just flew out to right field 0 for 5 tonight. But on a tremendous, tremendous defensive play that, you know, I guess that's why you get to World Series, when you have guys that can cross over second base and do other – I mean, where he threw the ball was where the second baseman was standing. I mean, that is a gamer play when you need it. Otherwise, the game's over.
Yep.
Otherwise, you would have seen Aroldis Chapman just go through this. Yeah.
They're a good team, obviously, but it's irritating when you go through like the Cubs lineup and they have, you know, Chris Bryant and Anthony Rizzo and you got all these players, and then you look, you know, you see like Lonnie Chisenhall.
Well, they have that same,
you know, like the Giants those years.
They're the White Sox in 2005 in a way that, you know, the Indians they've built a lot of pieces. It's very Moneyball if you think about it, because you have a couple. I mean, what's the kid who made the mistake last, the center fielder who made the mistake last night? Not a guy that on stats on paper that you're like, well, this guy's great. There's not impressive numbers. And, you know, I will give the Indians some credit. Carlos Carrasco, I say that in the whitest way possible. Carlos Carrasco, he was a dominant starting pitcher this year for the Cleveland Indians. And he had an injury, and I don't know if it was a blown out. It might have been a Tommy John situation towards the end in September. So to lose a Carlos Carrasco, and then a Danny Salazar as well, who we are now seeing, he's come back. He was activated for the World Series. He's done some work in middle relief.
Yeah.
But he's a starter.
Mm-hmm.
They went Kluber, Carrasco, Salazar, then maybe Trevor Bauer, then maybe Josh Tomlin.
Yeah.
Those guys, I mean, they were gone. There was a talk that the Cleveland Indians were going to get caught by the Tigers. They were not a team at the end. They were limping in.
And
not to mention Michael Brantley.
Arguably their best player.
He played 10 games.
Yeah.
One of the guys in my fantasy league kept Michael Brantley in the lineup the entire year.
Because he thought he was coming back?
No, because he's an idiot and he wasn't paying attention to his lineup.
He should be disqualified from joining next year.
Trust me, the winter leagues are going to be explosive. I mean, I'm the champion, so I get a bigger voice. I'm going to be like, that can't happen. They're rolling out the tarp in Cleveland. That's not a good sign. As the tarp rolls onto the field, it looks like we have a rain delay in Game 7 of the World Series. Rob Martier, what?
As you are saying that,
what?
I'm going to weather.com to take a look at their Cleveland radar.
Someone should go to history.com and see if this has ever happened before. A Game 7 with a rain delay.
I mean, it's coming down.
It is, of course. It's impossible to say how long this is. You're going to tell us how long it's going to take, but this is the same storm that came through Chicago today. That is not a good sign. The Chicago Cubs and Cleveland Indians tied in the top of the 10th inning.
They're showing the radar right now. It looks a little ominous.
Is Joe Buck telling us this is the greatest rainstorm Cleveland's ever seen? So essentially, these guys have to sit down. This does not bode well for either team who have their closers in the game. They can't come back out. If you're familiar with baseball at all, you know, once you go cold, you sit down for a little bit. They're not going to bring those guys back in. So this means we will see new pitchers on both sides in the dugout. Very interesting, though, because with a rain delay, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you can't start this game tomorrow, can you? I mean, you essentially sit this thing out till midnight, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock if you have to.
I would imagine so. I mean, all those people are there. I mean, to take the logistics involved in playing tomorrow.
And the idea that, I mean, how do you protect a field so it doesn't get completely soaked, waterlogged? Obviously, they're putting the tarp on the field, but, I mean, as you see, they're not going to cover the grass.
Yeah,
they're not going to cover, I mean, this is a pretty intense rainstorm that's coming through Cleveland right now. This is unprecedented, Rob Martier.
Well, here I guess is the good news. Let me put my Tom Skilling hat on here for just a second. There's a thin band of intense rain that's going through right now. It looks as though, and I saw it on the first page, this may only last about a half an hour to an hour at the most. When this clears out, there's no more rain until well into western Ohio. So they should be able to, hopefully, once this rain stops, get everybody back out there and complete the game.
This is so unprecedented. I mean, I don't know. I mean, obviously, there have been Game 7s of World Series throughout the last 120 years of baseball, but I can't tell you at all a situation in which there has been a rain delay this late in a World Series game. I mean, there's probably stats out the wazoo when it comes to how many of Game 7s have actually gone to extra innings. I mean, that's probably a very small percentage of Game 7s in the World Series where they've actually gone to extra innings.
So they should just stop the game and then bring it here, right?
Right. That's how it works. They'll do a flip the coin, and then tomorrow they'll just come back to Wrigley. They'll play the rest. They'll play the last, just the extra innings at Wrigley.
All right. Well, they just had the on-the-field guy for Fox speaking to one of the umpires, and they anticipate that this thing will blow through, and they do want to get this game completed tonight. So there you have
it. I can't even believe it, you guys. You guys, we're on the air in Chicago with a Game 7 Chicago Cub World Series, which is in rain delay in the extra innings. I mean, you can't get any more dramatic than that.
No.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my. All right, we'll take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. What a crazy, crazy turn of events. The World Series Game 7, a rain delay. In the top of the 10th inning, as the Cubs and Indians, who have just been battling, are tied 6-6. They will sit it out while the rain flows through Cleveland. We'll keep it here, 720 WGN. It's a download here on 720 WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, of course, we've got True Blue, the playoff plus the post game for tonight's wild Game 7. 6-6 starting in the top of the 10th inning, but right now in a rain delay. The guys, Andy Mazur and Adam Hoge, are here in studio. And in Cleveland, we've got Mark Carman and Kevin Powell. But Andy, Adam, I want to bring you in here. You can't even write this up in terms of the intensity that's happening right now.
Andy's about to run Joe Maddon out of town.
I feel like breaking something. I really do. I mean, and it's really difficult for me to criticize a manager who has won 200 regular season games over the last two seasons, but this started yesterday. There was no reason whatsoever to have Aroldis Chapman in that game yesterday. None. Zero. The guy had nothing today. He had absolutely nothing. And it's so frustrating. I mean, to see Hendricks taken out of the game when he was cruising.
Yeah.
To take Lester out.
There seemed to be a quick hook, obviously, putting one guy on base with two outs in both situations and going to the relief pitcher. That's something that obviously it's a World Series and you want to avoid situations like what happened with Chapman, obviously, when some people get tired, but yeah, you're going to have a lot of second guessing on the strategy tonight.
Well, some of the advanced numbers last night show that the Cubs win probability was up in the 90s when Joe Maddon made that decision to bring in Chapman, and that's just not a high leverage situation.
No.
It may have seemed like it to him, and I understand that it's the World Series and it's an elimination game, but the numbers did not show that was a high leverage situation. My big problem was leaving him in the ninth, and then tonight, I absolutely just don't understand taking Hendricks out of the game when he was pitching so well and bringing a guy in on short rest who's pitching in a situation that he's not used to pitching in coming out of the bullpen. It made no sense to me.
And it was supposed to be a clean inning. He came in with a runner on first base. That was the whole—
Maddon even said that.
That was the whole point of the press conference this afternoon, was that if he's going to come into the game, he's going to come in with nobody on base. So clean inning means nobody on base.
Well, right now, the game back underway, a quick rain delay, and they want to get this in before any more rain hits the field. The Cubs back up to bat, top of the 10th. Kyle Schwarber singles again to lead off the inning. That's his third hit of the night. pulled for a pinch runner and Albert Almora Jr. But a great night for Kyle Schwarber, guys. I mean, he did what he's supposed to do. Gets three hits, and here come the big sort of hitters for the Cubs lineup.
Yeah, the middle of the order's got to come through again. They've been doing it all night. And, you know, stranger things have happened where all these mistakes could actually still result in a win because, you know, Chapman, I guess, you know, you got to tip your hat a little bit. He got it down in the ninth. I mean, he, you know, was able to save the day there.
Yeah. All right, we'll let you guys get back to the game because I know you got to get ready for the post game. Obviously, Andy Mazur, Adam Hogue, Carm, and Kev in Cleveland will be all over this game as it just sort of hurdles to history in the sense that it's a playoff game or a World Series game seven in the extra innings in the top of the 10th inning. Andy, Adam, we'll talk to you guys in just a moment.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, thanks, guys. All right, so again, the Cubs are up to bat as we speak in the top of the 10th inning. We'll take a quick break here. We'll come back and we'll get you up to speed on everything that's happening as well as the news and traffic in the Chicago area. It's 720 WGN. Stay with us. Woo, what a night here at 720 WGN. Of course, Game 7 of the World Series in Chicago tonight. Not in Chicago, but it's on in Chicago. It's at Progressive Field in Cleveland. The Chicago Cubs and the Cleveland Indians tied up 6-6 in the top of the 10th inning. On a historic night, extra innings for a Game 7 of a World Series, not to mention a rain delay. They just came back, and the Cubs have runners on first and second with one out in the top of the 10th inning. How it happened, Kyle Schwarber hit a single to right to start the inning. He was removed for pinch runner Albert Almora Jr. The next batter, Chris Bryant, hit a long fly ball to center field that just missed getting out of the park. It was corralled at the warning track, but Albert Almora really does a tremendous job in that situation, tagging up for first base and being able to move up to second, close play at second, to be able to get into scoring position. Anthony Rizzo then intentionally walked to put runners at first and second with one out. Shaw is the pitcher. Ben Zobrist is at the plate. Woo! How you doing, Pete?
I'm good. I'm confident. I was actually really pleasantly surprised to hear Andy Mazur being so upset with Joe Madden because I feel the same rage.
It's hard because, you know, I think Joe Madden has been a tremendous, tremendous manager for the Cubs. I mean, he's become sort of, you know, he is Papa Smurf. He's done everything right. He won 103 games. I mean, really unprecedentedly. I mean, he doesn't get second guessed much at all. Haroldis Chapman, if you're joining us late, or maybe he fell asleep. Aroldis Chapman yesterday was called on to pitch in a game that was really in hand for the Cubs. And he was called on in the seventh inning. He threw two innings. He came out in the ninth when Pedro Strop makes a tremendous, tremendous appearance. One life-changing for Pedro Strop. Pedro Strop came in to finish that game out. All right, so here we are. I was waiting just a second as that was happening, just so I'm not a play-by-play guy. It's not our broadcast. But I will say that Ben Zobrist comes through with a double down the left field line to score Albert Almora Jr. He moves Anthony Rizzo to third base. The Cubs have a 7-6 lead in the top of the 10th inning in Game 7 of the World Series.
I have to apologize because you were, you know, telling the story and I was sitting here. We're looking at each other and I like lifted my arms up and like rejoicing.
There's this old adage, and Rose really big into this too, that, you know, it's not our broadcast. I can't be like second and third. Here's the pitch. And there's I can't do that. I'm not doing play by play. We just express written consent of the MLB. I do not have. So there has to be a pause in sort of, you know, the idea of not being able to do play-by-play. So it's really interesting. That moment I'm talking about, you know, Pedro Strope. Unbelievable. All right. So Addison Russell walked intentionally to load the bases. The Cleveland Indians in quite a jam here. The bases loaded. The Cubs behind Ben Zobrist. Tony Kukoc, Ben Zobrist. early on. That's, you know, what we talked about early in this. They say we haven't had this much stress since the Bulls in 98 went to the, I think it was the Eastern Conference Finals against the Indiana Pacers. They had a Game 7. They were down 20, I think, in the third quarter. And Tony Kukoc came through for the team when Jordan and Pippen weren't getting it done to bring them to an NBA championship series against the Jazz. Tonight, who was going to be Tony Kukoc? It turns out Ben Zobrist comes through. He was 0 for 4 in this game.
He's had a good World Series yeah. up until today.
So now you got the bases loaded for Miguel Montero, who came in the game after David Ross, I believe it was the ninth inning, walked and then was replaced for a pinch runner. So Miguel Montero in the game. Miguel Montero is catching. Be interesting to see, Pete, what do you do with the relief pitching here?
Yeah, who comes in?
Do you do Aroldis Chapman?
Montgomery?
I mean, he was warming up. Montgomery might be your save guy in the World Series. Yeek. I don't know. Do you have a thought?
Mike Montgomery. I mean, Joe Maddon has expressed.
Wow, they're showing a picture of Carl Edwards Jr. warming up.
Maybe he's got the matchups for the upcoming batters. But I know, like Joe Maddon has said, that, you know, in a couple of press conferences, that he trusts Chapman and Montgomery, and that's about it, in his bullpen.
So coming up in the bottom of the 10th, and I don't have it in front of me. I'm just going off of memory. But Francisco Lindor made the final out. In the ninth. There's a, I guess I could say it, right? I mean, we're in the World Series Game 7. Miguel Montero comes through with a base hit to add an insurance run. The Chicago Cubs now have an 8-6 lead in the top of the 10th inning. Miguel Montero comes through with a base hit to the left side. He does not score the runner from second. Ben Zobrist has to hold at three because it was essentially a softly hit ball. But Miguel Montero comes through in the top of the 10th inning of the World Series, Game 7, with a single to give the Cubs an insurance run. 8-6 Cubs in the top of the 10th inning. This is crazy! Woo! And you know what? Still loaded. Still loaded. One out. The Cubs, you know, you always
keep on piling on.
I gotta say, always see this happen after a rain delay. You know, where teams are real tight and they're playing through, but now you see, you know, after a rain delay, that happens almost all the time, where you get the situation where, you know, a team's gonna, you know, jump. And I thought it was very surprising that they brought Shaw back out. The Cleveland Indians already used Allen. They already used Miller. Shaw was in the game in the ninth inning to shut down the top of the ninth for the Cubs. The rain delay happened, and it was long enough. I mean, probably a little bit over 15 minutes, 20 minutes. And instead of going to a fresh arm to start the top of the 10th, the Indians stick with Shaw. Shaw not having a good – I mean, the only out was Chris Bryant's near-miss home run to center field. Not a great showing for Shaw, who's in his second inning. And the Indians, who have been as stingy with their bullpen, they go to three guys and that's about it, are in a position where they have to decide who's going to come in, if anybody, if they stay with Shaw, to try and shut down this rally so it doesn't get out of hand.
It's so weird now, in this day and age. I've been watching a lot of analysis on MLB Network and whatnot about how pitching is played in games like this, where, you know, like in the old days, you know, Greg Maddux probably would have pitched eight innings, or John Smoltz would have pitched eight innings.
Even up there,
you know?
I feel like it's only changed in the last
couple of years. Yeah.
I mean, the Kansas City Royals kind of did that, where they'd have Yordan Ventura pitch two innings or three innings, and then they'd go to their crazy bullpen and had some great relievers in the middle. They do that. San Francisco Giants did that too as well, right?
It makes me, you know, it makes you long for the days of...
Well, the 2005 White Sox had Freddie Garcia, Jose Contreras, Mark Burley, John Garland, who pitched into games. I mean, they pitched to the seventh, eighth inning. I mean, they had some historical number in how many innings they ate and how many earned runs they didn't give up. But
you guys were lucky you had a sweep.
Yeah, I mean, there was an extra innings game in there. I believe it was the Jeff Blum game where he hit a home run down the right field line in extras, and a game that I believe, and I was just going over this because they were just I think it was the final, they were showing like a 10-year kind of recap or something because of this World Series. There was one of those games where they blew the lead in the top of the ninth, and Scotty Pasednik hit the home run to take it back. So that, I mean, that happened in two different games, plus a Konerko Grand Slam in there somewhere too. So right now, the Chicago Cubs lead in Game 7 of the World Series in the top of the 10th inning, 8-6 after a tremendous, tremendous rally here, after a rain delay. Took a rain delay. The Cleveland Indians have changed pitchers. They've gone to Trevor Bauer. Trevor Bauer, the Game 2 and Game 5 starter? Would that would have been it? Yeah, because I think Kluber did 4. Game 2 and Game 5 starter for the Cleveland Indians. He is also known as Drone Finger, as he is the pitcher who hurt his finger, cut his finger open, trying to fix his drone or clean his drone.
Yeah. Had some weird injuries.
Some Kipnis weird injuries.
Celebrating, you know, had the bad ankle from celebrating.
Right. So the
He's
Indians.
From Northbrook, you know.
Just. Yeah, right. Yeah. Kipnis is from Northbrook. So the Indians, right now, with their backs against the wall, with one out, bases loaded, Jason Hayward up to bat. The Cubs have the bases loaded. They've got Zobrist on third, Addison Russell on second. And who's on first? Miguel Montero on first.
And the looks on the faces of the fielders out there for the Indians basically tells the story. They're all slack-jawed, wondering what happened.
Yeah, but at some point they were as well, right? I mean, they were, it felt like maybe they were thinking that back in the seventh inning and they made that triumphant off of Aroldis Chapman. So it'd be interesting here. I mean, I don't think this, unfortunately for the Cubs, the game's not over. You know, they still have to deal with an Indians lineup that's going to be, I believe, the heart. I mean, you're talking about a Carlos Santana, a Mike Napoli, if they're still in the game. I don't know if players have been changed around. I haven't paid that close attention while we've been doing the show if guys have been pinch run for or taken out. But it should be a situation where, you know, if they haven't been replaced for defensive reasons, you're going to see the big hitters of the Jose Ramirez as well will be coming up this inning. So let's take a break. We'll get an update with Rob Martyr as well here, and we'll keep you abreast of what's happening with the Cubs and Indians in Game 7 of the World Series out in Cleveland. Stay with us. Long night here in Chicago, but what a thrilling night. Wow. The heart rate of the city in the Chicagoland area is up. That's how it works. I'm Justin Kaufman in with you for an extended show tonight as the Chicago Cubs are in extra innings in Cleveland. Game 7 of the World Series. With me, Rob Martyr, Pete Zimmerman, Esmeralda Leon, the playoff, the true blue playoff push. Playoff Plus, sorry, True Blue Playoff Plus postgame show will be coming up right here after the show with Andy Mazur and Adam Hoge. Kevin Powell and Mark Carmen are in Philadelphia. We have people as well, Ryan Burrow, Kristen Decker, are out in Wrigleyville. There's a lot going on. Of course, you heard from Esmeralda.
Are they in Cleveland?
They are not
you
in
said Philadelphia.
I said Philadelphia?
Yes.
Mm. No, they're in Wrigleyville.
No.
Oh, I got it, sorry. I said Philadelphia?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Am I there, Pete? Did you not hear them?
Philadelphia, yeah.
No. No, they're in Cleveland. I'm sorry. I don't know why I said Philadelphia. That's crazy. They're in Cleveland right now, Progressive Field, of course, and the Cubs have two outs in the bottom of the 10th inning. The Cleveland Indians down to their last out. The Chicago Cubs with an 8-6 lead here in the bottom of the 10th inning. This is absolutely stunning. What a game. If you're just joining, the Cubs had a big lead, a three-run lead in the eighth inning. Aroldis Chapman coughed it up. The game was tied. We went into the ninth inning. Then an unprecedented rain delay as extra innings began, something where we thought it might be an hour plus, but it was only like 15, 20 minutes. Cubs came up in the top of the 10th inning, and they were able to score two runs to take the lead 8-6, and that's where we're at right now. Carl Edwards Jr. is in the game as the relief pitcher because Aroldis Chapman is out, of course. He pitched two innings, and he is so far so good and possibly the future closer for the Cubs. We shall see. We'll talk. We have plenty of offseason to talk about that. But as we wait right now, the Chicago Cubs are on the mound. Carl Edwards Jr. on the mound. This is crazy.
Once this game comes to its conclusion, perhaps the Cubs do, in fact, hold on here to get this last out. I want to ask Andy if he's still very angry with Joe Maddon.
A World Series championship probably forgives the manager for pitching missteps, if you will, strategy missteps.
Mm-hmm. Ultimately won the game.
Yep. I mean, that's what it'll be looked at. I mean, I doubt they'll say, hey, remember when the Cubs won that World Series? Remember that eighth inning when Joe Maddon took out John Lester to get to Aroldis Chapman? Do you remember Game 6? And that where Chapman, we won't ever talk about that again. There's so many, you know, storylines that go throughout the World Series that we're so into right now. We're so, you know, focused on that won't be an issue when it comes time if the Cubs can actually hold on and pull this off.
I'm getting ahead of myself. I understand that, but excited. Have they said anything about a possible parade? Route?
I've heard rumors, only unsubstantiated, that they're looking at a Monday.
Oh.
But, I mean, all sort of, you know, conventional wisdom would say, why not do that on a Friday? 2 days, they're back. We do it on Friday right into the weekend. But we're not sure how that's going to play.
You don't want it on a weekend.
Right. Well, there's still a lot to go here.
Right.
We're not out of it. We still have two outs to go. Carl Edwards Jr., he walks. He walks a batter to put a tying run at the plate. And the tying run, of course, is Rajah Davis, the hero.
I can't write this.
The eighth inning where he hit a two-run homer off of Aroldis Chapman to tie the game in the bottom of the eighth. He's up again here in the bottom of the 10th. Brandon Guyer, I believe, is the person he walked to, is on first base now. Rajah Davis comes up again. I mean, amazing. I mean, let's say that Rajah Davis makes the last out for the Cleveland Indians here. Hero and GOAT in the same game.
Yeah.
That's a tough situation. I mean, this is Ryan Sandberg territory. 84 Cubs against the St. Louis Cardinals kind of thing, where you're asked upon to essentially hit two-run homers in a game here to tie the game. It's a very difficult thing to do for a baseball player in Rajah Davis, who is not known as a power hitter.
No. They keep on showing Theo Epstein. He's got a child on his lap.
Sat it on the lap since the ninth inning. That's a long time to have a child on the lap there. And that child, I give them a lot of credit because that child has been up and continues.
Right, and it's 12:43 in Cleveland.
Amazing. It's amazing. Brandon Guyer takes second base. Nobody stopped him. So he is on second base. Rajah Davis. So Rajah Davis hits a double, or a single, I'm sorry, a single, that brings Brandon Guyer home from second base. So the Cubs now with an 8-7 lead here going into the two outs in the bottom of the 10th inning.
Unbelievable.
I can't handle this.
They say you bring in Montgomery now.
Joe Maddon coming out to the mound. So, yeah, I think he is. We'll see what happens there. But, yeah, so Rajah Davis, what a World Series for him. I mean, a journeyman who came to the Indians to really be a last-minute season addition to the team, having a tremendous, tremendous Game 7, a two-run homer against Chapman, and here in the ninth or the 10th with two outs. Runner on second, able to hit Carl Edwards Jr. and bring the run home. So Rajah Davis now a speedster on first base.
Right.
Which is interesting because he can't steal bases.
You have Mike Montgomery coming in, a lefty, which will control that a bit. But then you have Montero, who's not as good as Ross, and
Contreras
throwing out runners.
Pretty amazing here.
Just go after the batter. Just get the batter out, Mike Montgomery.
Right. I mean, it's really what it comes down to. I mean, and you know, there's just so much drama. I mean, it's amazing to me that there was so much hype today for this game. I mean, it was amazing how people were just walking around almost like zombies. It was very a sleepwalking day. Everyone was just waiting for tonight. And in the back of your mind, you're like, well, I don't want this to be a blowout. Almost one way or the other. I mean, obviously, if it was a blowout for the Cubs, you'd be like, oh, that's okay.
Yeah,
but you didn't want to be in a situation where it's like, oh, this hype, and it doesn't come through.
Yeah.
And here we are in the bottom of the 10th inning with two outs. A runner in on first and a one-run lead.
It's too bad they can't play another game tomorrow in that they're probably gaining some new fans. Like, boy, baseball's exciting.
Yeah.
Is every game like this?
Right. My wife texted me and said, why can't they bring the guy in who started the game to pitch?
Hendricks.
He was pretty good. I'm like, no, all right. I'm not going to explain the entire. I can't do it.
It's like me when I watch the when I'm watching like the hockey playoffs, and then you know trying to explain icing every April, I find myself explaining icing.
It's a family. It's a ritual. This is pretty amazing. I mean, you couldn't ask for anything more. I mean, to have two leads in the game. To have comebacks for the Indians, but still be able to take the lead with, you know, what Ben Zobrist and his big hit to take the lead now. Yikes! I mean, here we are. The Miguel Montero single holds as the lead run last inning. So right now, the Cubs with an 8-7 lead as Mike Montgomery warms up to try and get one out. I mean, the only thing you could say is that at least Mike Montgomery, this could be like the seventh inning. It's a hold situation. It's not an unfamiliar territory. Right? Carl Edwards Jr., a little unfamiliar territory to come in a closing situation. This is almost what Mike Montgomery was brought in to do all season long since he came over, was to sort of get an out in the seventh inning, right? To, like, get you to the next guy, to move you to Chapman. So he's at least versed in the concept of coming in to face one batter. And interestingly enough, the batter that is at the plate is the, and I don't know who this is, but this is the guy that they did.
Martinez?
Martinez is the defensive.
Yeah.
He brought in to replace, was it to replace Carlos Santana?
Coco Crisp, maybe?
Coco Crisp, right. But this would be Coco Crisp at this stage. Here it is. And there it is! The Chicago Cubs are the World Series champions for the first time in 108 years. The 2016 Chicago Cubs are world champions. They win the World Series in Cleveland. Game 7, you can hear it. Celebrating on the field at Progressive Field, the Chicago Cubs win the World Series in 10 innings. A ground ball to Chris Bryant. Chris Bryant throws across the diamond, and he gets Martinez on a ground ball. Tremendous, tremendous game. The Chicago Cubs are World Series champions. Let that sink in, Chicago. The Chicago Cubs, world champions. How about it, Pete? How you feeling? You feel good?
Feeling great.
How about it? You know, it's interesting because this is something that we've been talking about for the last 2 months, and so many people could not believe that this might happen to them in their lifetime. So many generations have talked about this. The idea of winning a World Series is something that they could not fathom. The losing streak is over. 108 years, the Chicago Cubs are World Series champions. It's amazing to me that this happened. Should we get right to bring Andy and Adam in, bring them in on the selector, get them in here. Andy, Adam, what's your take? The Chicago Cubs, Wrigleyville is jumping. They're showing it everywhere. A very exciting finish to this playoff atmosphere, this run, this 2016 team. We'll get to them in just a second as we go. It's amazing to me that the Cubs are on the field right now. Sirens are going off. We've got police cars going down Michigan Avenue. The shots of Wrigleyville are tremendous. If you get a chance to see it, there are audience members, people at Progressive Field who are crying. A tremendous, tremendous game. The Chicago Cubs win the World Series. They are World Series champions, the 2016 Cubs. I mean, unbelievable. I mean, this is a moment to be Chicagoan, to be on the air on 720 WGN. Do you believe in miracles? Yes, we do. Unbelievable. The Chicago Cubs have won the World Series 2016. They're world champions for the first time in 108 years. It's a tremendous, tremendous, tremendous night for Chicago. It's a tremendous night in Chicago history, not just sports, but history. What a night. I mean, this is something that you dream of as a baseball fan. To be in a situation where In 2016, the Chicago Cubs are World Series champs. It's pretty tremendous, and you can tell from what we see not only on the field, and we're going to check in with Mark Carmen and Kevin Powell in just a moment as we make a transition to the postgame, to True Blue Playoff Plus. Andy Mazur and Adam Hoge are going to be joining me in studio. Adam Hoge joining me now. Adam Hoge, what a tremendous, tremendous Game 7!
Oh, my God. I mean, wow. Somehow we got to find a way to put words into sentences and and put them through this microphone. Andy needs 10 minutes. I told him take his time because he was literally on the ground in tears. I'm not even kidding. And I'm sure that's the overwhelming sentiment all over the city with Cubs fans. That game was insane.
It really was. What a capper to a 2016 season. Oh. 103 wins in the regular season. A very eventful, dramatic a playoff run, including a World Series where the Cubs fell behind 3-1. They win the last three, and in the final Game 7, dramatic fashion, blowing a lead, going into extras, a rain delay. You had it all.
Yeah, I mean, really, you couldn't put anything else in there. Joe Maddon, look, they won in spite of their manager tonight. He made some crazy decisions that thank God the Cubs didn't lose this game.
Right.
I mean, because he would have been dealing with that forever. Forever. Even if they go on to win another, win a World Series, had they lost this one, they'd still be talking about 2016 when Joe Maddon overmanaged Game 7. So, I mean, his players bailed him out tonight, and the Cubs did it. It happened.
It's unbelievable. Adam Hoge in studio. We'll get Carm's going to join us from Progressive. Also, Kevin Powell. We'll have some WGN staff, Ryan Burrow, Kristen Decker up in Wrigleyville, which is going crazy right now. Adam, it's too early, but it's going to be the situation here in probably in the next 10, 15 minutes. We'll have an MVP. My choice for MVP, Ben Zobrist, what a tremendous series for him and a huge hit at the right time tonight.
I don't know how it's not Zobrist. You know, we dared to have this discussion last night because it's a great sports radio topic.
Right.
And I said Zobrist last night and everyone kept saying, well, maybe Chapman, and I got that, but Chapman didn't do his job tonight. So
no,
there's no way he can win it. And Zobrist was the best player. Most consistent. Let's put it that way: the most consistent player throughout the seven games.
Cubs. And what you were looking for was a moment where Ben Zobrist changed the course of a game because he had a tremendous sort of series at the plate. But it was a lot of hits. It wasn't a lot of RBIs or clutch at bats. But tonight in the top of the 10th inning, Ben Zobrist comes through with a huge clutch hit to give the Cubs the lead. And the Cubs win the World Series. I can't believe I'm saying that. Holy cow! Holy cow, Cubs win.
That was what Andy, and I'll let him kind of share his sentiments when he comes down here, but that's what he kept saying. He couldn't stop saying it to himself. I watched the Cubs win a World Series.
It actually
happened, and I think, boy, this city's going to be lit up tonight. Driving down a few hours ago, there were cops all over the road. They were on standby at every intersection. They're on horses, bikes, buses, cars, they're ready for. I came down the security here at Tribune Towers on high alert because it's gonna be insane tonight. You know what? Go crazy, enjoy it. You Cubs fans.
Well, let's bring in Andy Mazur, who joins us now. Andy, your thoughts on a World Series win for the Chicago Cubs?
Okay, that happened, right?
It happened.
This is not a joke.
This is not a joke. This is not
a
drill.
It's November 2nd. It's not April 1st. Okay.
What a roller coaster, dramatic finish for this 2016 season. The Chicago Cubs are World Series champions. Andy, you've been a lifelong fan.
Yeah.
What does it mean to you and the city and everyone involved to be in this moment right now where the Cubs are World Series champions?
You know, people my age, I'm going to turn 50 next year, have seen every other team in this city win a championship. And it's the Cubs that have been the only team to not win it. It's complete. It's so fitting. And I didn't even think about it as I was upstairs trying to compose myself and have a conversation with my dad. We were talking about my grandfather, who would have been 108 on November 5th.
Wow.
He missed it by 3 weeks. He missed the last one by 3 weeks. And he's been gone for several years. I think that's what it means the most. I think it's a generational thing. I think it's something right now that people are taking in very personally. And, trying to reach out and call whoever they can reach at this ungodly hour, you know, with all that. But, you know, it's so funny. I was trying to compose myself upstairs, and Cubs players were being interviewed after the game, and they all are crediting the rain delay for bringing it together. They said that Jason Hayward called a meeting in the weight room, got them all together. They got refocused.
Wow.
They came out, and it wasn't easy. But you know what? After 108 years, it shouldn't have been easy, right?
It's amazing to me, and you hit it on the head. I mean, 773 just said, text in, for all the great-grandparents, the grandparents who are no longer with us, the generations before that haven't been able to have a Cubs victory, this means much, much more than just a championship for a city when it comes to a specific sport. This is something that's family. For Chicago Cubs fans, this is something you've been waiting for 108 years. The Cubs are World Series champions.
And I want to see what the national media, what they're going to say next. You know, I mean, they already had their narratives ready to go if the Cubs blew this. They already had the narratives ready. They knew that they were, you know, that this was going to be a crazy game anyway. But they had the narrative ready. Listen, guys, you got to give them their due. This is a team that backed it up. They won 103 regular season games. Most of the time, the team that wins the most games and is the best record in baseball does not win the World Series.
Baseball, right?
Not this team. This team did it.
Adam, what's it mean? I mean, obviously, what you guys are going to be on, we'll talk about this all night, 312-981-7200. But this team, this 2016 team, has shown something that a lot of other Chicago Cubs teams have not been able to, and that's resolve. There is this I don't know what it is, the emotional response to being down, to having two outs, to being in the ninth inning, whatever it is, the Chicago Cubs down 3-1, they find a way to crawl back in. They don't seem to be at all worried or even fazed by adversity.
Well, I mean, this is a baseball team. Simply put, I mean, they do everything that if you're a lover of the game of baseball, you have to appreciate this Cubs team. They play outstanding defense. They have a fun lineup. The starting pitching's there. They you know, the bullpen was the weakness of this team. They made the moves. It's Montgomery who gets the last out, a guy you traded for. And it's all put together with a good manager who I think had a rough series, a really rough night tonight. But overall, you got to give Joe Maddon a lot of credit for pulling this team together the way he did the last two seasons. I don't know that they're here this quickly without Joe. And it's just, they're great guys. There's only one guy, I've said this multiple times, I don't like Aroldis Chapman for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. It does make me happy to see him blow the save tonight and still kind of have the Cubs win. Got the win, yeah. And that jerk still, you know, had what's coming to him, and he's not going to be a part of this team. So you can say, you know what, optics matter. I said this when the Cubs traded for him. Is that the guy you really want holding the ball for the final out of the World Series?
Yeah.
Guess what? It didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
So awesome. You know, it's going to be Mike Montgomery who you see in all the highlights for the next century or so, not that jerk.
Now, okay, we're going to have an MVP trophy at some point or another, but let me talk about the real MVP of this team, and it has to be Theo Epstein.
Yep.
He comes over here with a plan. He says it, and you never see this in major sports, especially in a major city. Hey, we're going to be bad for a couple of years, but you know what? If you stay with us, we'll turn it around. He was good on his word. He came through on his promise. Tremendous, tremendous general manager.
Yeah, and he knew the type of players to go and get. And I know that there was a lot of stress within that inner circle going forward and trading for Aroldis Chapman just for those reasons, you know, with the domestic violence situation that he had and that, you know, was suspended by Major League Baseball for. You know, there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of gut-wrenching times, you know, trying to pull the trigger on that because they really wanted to get quality people in here. Look what Ben Zobrist did tonight.
Right.
Look what Miguel Montero did tonight. Look at other guys, you know, obviously draft choices like Chris Bryant and Albert Almora may have had the most heads-up play of anybody in the game tonight, tagging up from first base to get the second on the deep flyout. So Carl Edwards, the guy they traded for. So, I mean, there's good guys in this clubhouse, and David Ross, I'm so happy for that guy going out of champ.
Unbelievable. This is what a night here in Chicago. The Chicago Cubs have won the World Series.
Can you say that one more time, please?
One more time. Of course we will. The Chicago Cubs have won the World Series, the first win in 108 years. They are world champions. A tremendous, tremendous game tonight. Extra innings win in Game 7 of the World Series after a rain delay. So much more to talk about tonight. Andy and Adam are going to do so. Mark Carm and Kevin Powell also at Progressive. We'll bring them in after the news. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. We also have people standing by in Wrigleyville as well. We'll get to all that.